J-I-M.
Yeah.
I'm going to call the House Committee on Energy and Environment to order. Our first issue of business today is an informational meeting. I'll talk about that in a minute. I think folks are still signing in for the bills that they want to speak on. For folks that have signed up to testify today and others, we're going to be first doing an informational meeting and covering that information. Then I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2131, and I'll invite a number of I'll invite testimony by the bill sponsors. Some of our tribal representatives are here. I want to get them up early. A representative from the governor's office. And then some folks from DEQ and some of our state agencies. And then I'll open up a public hearing for House Bill 3344 as well after that. And we can and let people testify on whichever bill that they want to after that. I'm going to try to get the folks that are from 100 miles or more away from the state capitol done first. And get you back on the road if you want to head home. We're not going to have time to get through all the testimony before my committee needs to go do the things that they do with the rest of their time. But I will be here to take testimony beyond that. I don't, you know, if we get past six, I might start thinking about shutting it down. But we'll try to get through all the testimony tonight. So if you're here to speak, know that you'll be heard, and of course you can submit a written testimony either today or to our assistants for and our analysts to be posted on OLIS. So there's many different ways that you can make your voices heard. With that, I'm going to invite up our panel for the informational meeting. Mariana, Andrew, Hal, and Daniel, come on up. Ahead when you're ready.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Mariana Reese Temple. I'm the Chief Deputy with the Office of State Fire Marshal. Thank you for this opportunity to meet with you today, and we will be presenting on crude oil by rail transportation and emergency preparedness. Myself and my colleagues from Oregon Department of Transportation, Office of Emergency Management, and to my left, Chief Hamill with Mid-Columbia Fire and Rescue.
Chair Hill, member of the committee, my name is Hal Gard. I'm the administrator of the Rail and Public Transit Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you for having me here today. I really wanted to just give you an update on the trends in oil transport in the U.S. and here in Oregon. A few changes in federal regulations and our response to those changes, and really kind of outline the progress we've made towards reducing derailments within the state. ODOT Rail Safety Unit, we've been actively involved in efforts to address the oil safety concerns within the state since we saw the large uptick in shipments starting in 2014. We worked in partnership with everybody you see here and many other folks around the state. My unit in particular, works to prevent train derailments primarily through inspections, and both inspection, enforcement, and education efforts with the railroads and with rail shippers. And then we also have a role in accident investigation that we do in concert with FRA. The majority of transportation of hazardous material, including crude oil, is regulated by federal law. The vast majority of authority is federal. It's either through the Federal Rail Administration, the Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration, or is regulated under the Interstate Commerce Act. Railroads are common carriers, and it's important to understand that if it's legal to ship and it's properly packaged, then a railroad has to carry the product. However, we're authorized and we participate in a partnership program with Federal Rail Administration that adds ODOT rail inspectors to the ranks of federal inspectors, and we act under their authority. Our inspectors are certified in one of five disciplines, either track, hazmat, motor power and equipment, operations, signals, and train control. And an inspector is only allowed to be certified in only a single discipline, given the complexity of those topics. The volume accrued by rail in Oregon and the United States, it increased dramatically in 2013, as depicted in this chart. But since 2014, we've seen a sharp decline across the state. And that sharp decline actually has been repeated in Oregon. And the reason I've got a little highlighted bar on 2016 is I don't have the final official numbers in Oregon. This is based upon quarterly carload data, and I don't expect to have that final number until the end of April. But based upon what we're seeing nationally, that pretty well holds true. These are the primary crude oil train routes in Oregon. We have the BNSF trunk line that runs through the central Oregon. And they hauled oil both directions. We have the UP line that runs through the Columbia River Gorge coming out of Washington. And we have the UP main that runs down the Willamette Valley. And then we have a small line called the Astoria line that runs from Portland out to Port Westward. And they have hauled both crude to an offload facility at Port Westward as well as ethanol. So there's been a lot of federal action around the uptick in movement of oil by rail. The U.S. Department of Transportation finalized rules on the 1st of May in 2015 entitled Enhanced Tank Car Standards and Operational Controls for High Hazard Flammable Trains. The rule addressed enhanced braking, tank car standards, operating speeds, route risk assessment, route notification, all around what are called these high hazardous flammable trains. And a high hazard flammable train is defined one of two ways. It's either a train transporting 20 cars in block, so they're all together within the train, or it has 35 cars transporting hazard or highly flammable material dispersed throughout the train's consist, one or the other. Most of the crude is moved by unit train, which are very, very large continuous blocks that don't have any other material within the train. One of the results of the new U.S. DOT rules was creation of new tank car specification called the DOT 117, and it has increased safety features throughout and a phase-out schedule so that the older, what are called DOT 111s, will be removed from service, starting with the oldest first. And that window or timeline for that phase-out begins January 1st, 2018, and the last deadline for decommissioning of those old cars is May 1st, 2025. A couple of the other key safety features that came through federal law, enhanced braking, basically starts braking to the train from both sides of the train. That is currently under study. There's some concerns whether or not that's a panacea in terms of quicker braking. Reduced operating speeds. It reduces the overall speed of high-hazard flammable trains to 50 miles per hour in all areas, or in areas that are considered high-threat urban areas. With older cars, the trains can't exceed 40 miles an hour. There's also a requirement for more accurate classification of the product, basically trying to address the concerns around dissolved volatile gases within the crude itself. And then rail routing and risk assessments, basically requiring the railroad considers the pathways they take and the condition of track when they're moving oil across the country. Finally, a couple of words about trends. As a department, we're quite proud of the fact that we've had what we like to consider a pretty good role in the reduction of derailments across the state. From a high of 80 in 2004 to the current low of about 14. And when we talk about derailments, that's any derailment that causes slightly over $10,000 in damage. And it can happen in many places. It's not necessarily a mainline derailment. Those can be simple yard accidents where maybe two cars brush against each other and cause some damage. Those are all reportable under the law. In 2014, to kind of address the concern in the uptick, we added four additional rail inspectors. We added two additional folks in track, since that's an area where we have the most concern with regard to derailments, and then one additional inspector in the other disciplines, bringing it up. And basically, more inspectors allow us to find more defects, spend a little more time out on the rails, and making sure that we're finding any of those issues that can lead to a derailment. And we're thinking that's work. It's working for us. In 2015, ODOT was identified by FRA as one of the top safety groups in the country, and that's based upon numbers of hours of inspection divided by the number of defects found within the state. In 2014, we also worked with an advisory committee, with some of the folks that you see up here, to review and revise our administrative rules relating to railroad reporting and hazardous material movements. That revised rule was adopted in 2014, basically requiring that the railroads submit a quarterly report to ODOT on the type and quantity and routes of hazardous material shipped across the state. Immediate notification of the Oregon Emergency Response System of any release of hazardous material. Make information about the rail cars and locomotives involved in a derailment immediately available. And provide ODOT with basically miscellaneous information relating to railroad operations, such as timetables and emergency response telephone numbers. And with that, that concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
We'll hold questions till the end of the panel, so go right ahead.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Power, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. Again, my name is Mariana Rees-Temple with the Office of State Fire Marshal, and I'm going to be speaking to the 2015 legislation, House Bill 3225, and the work that our office has done since its inception. House Bill 3225 directed our office to coordinate training, response planning, and preparedness efforts with a specific focus on oil and hazmat train derailment incidents. In part, this law also charged our office with adopting by rule a plan for coordinated response to such spills and train all emergency responders for that type of response. House Bill 3225 also provided funding for a new hazmat rail position, which we filled, and they started work in 2016. And this position has focused on coordinating the response planning, equipment acquisition, and deployment within the hazmat response system in Oregon, and training of our local emergency responders. A number of our successes have been achieved in regards to this planning. Our office has participated and contributed to the creation of a hazmat rail incident response plan in Columbia County. So this is the very first local emergency planning committee in the state of Oregon that actually has a local hazmat rail response plan. And the reason this is significant is our office is also looking at taking this and doing a statement of work so that we can use this response plan in other communities in Oregon as well as other local emergency planning committees. And so this is a really important thing for the state of Oregon, and we hope that we're able to create a bigger footprint in terms of the planning effort. So something that we're happy to see, and we'd like to thank the local emergency planning committee and all the folks in Columbia County for their work on that. Additionally, through funding allocated in House Bill 3225, our office intends to help these local emergency planning committees and communities that have transportation by providing funding for exercises and additional tabletops, which we all know is one of the three key components in ensuring that there's a coordinated response. We talk about planning, training, and exercise, and so that is a big focus of our office will be for the exercise planning of those LEPCs and the communities that have transportation through their communities of crude oil and hazmat. We also want to continue to support the local emergency response planning efforts by facilitating access to the reports of crude oil shipments as required by the federal executive order. So Halgard indicated that a unit car has a certain amount of transportation, so that's a certain amount of crude oil. So once it reaches 1 million gallons of Bakken crude oil, the federal executive order indicated that the rails have to report to the CERC, the State Emergency Response Commission, which is our office, where those shipments are in Oregon. And so we have worked with the railroad. We have that information, and we have provided that to emergency responders. In addition, we are promoting the mobile application. It's called Ask Rail, and that was developed by the rail industry to permit first responders live access to what's on the train, what's in a specific rail car, and that's to be used in the time of emergency. And so we have facilitated the use of that with our hazmat teams as well as other fire departments that want access to that information. Our rail coordinator has taken several steps to inventory and acquire essential equipment for response. Through a voluntary commitment of the resources, BNSF and UP has worked with our office and has placed 8 foam firefighting trailers throughout the state of Oregon. These are placed strategically across the state and mainly with our state hazmat teams, but in some cases other fire departments based on the amount of transportation of crude oil in their communities. So those are fully implemented within our response system. And we did use 2 of those during the Mosier derailment. Our rail coordinator also has uploaded key response assets to what we call WORL, which is an Environmental Protection Agency-sponsored online database where private and state and local assets have been uploaded so that incident commanders and planners have access to this information so that they know where the rail assets or state assets are in terms of response for equipment. BNSF and UP have donated retired rail tank cars currently for training. So currently there is one that was just placed at the Eugene Fire training facility and one that will be placed at the Department of Public Safety and Standards training in Salem, Oregon. That is key because, as we know, sending folks to training to Pueblo, which is where the premier site is currently, is a lot of money, and it costs a lot of money for local responders and local departments in our office to send those folks there. So we're trying to build a bigger footprint for training, be more efficient, and provide hands-on training in Oregon for Oregon responders for Oregon incidents. So that's something that we're really excited to see. In addition, we have about 5 more that have been donated, so we're excited to work with our responders and our planners to determine where those will be placed in 2017. We've also purchased, through the funding of House Bill 3225, 13 gas monitors that detect for benzene, which is a product of crude oil, and those will be placed in 13 state hazmat teams throughout the state, and that'll happen within this year. The main focus for training, which is another of the important focus or training, planning, training, and exercise, a big focus has been in training. And in 2016, we facilitated and delivered over 2,500 hours of training on hazmat rail. So what we're trying to do is use that tiered approach to coordinate training at all levels. And I believe our office submitted to everyone an annual report. And in there, on page 8, it talks about the different trainings. And so we're trying to provide training at all levels, from local volunteer firefighters, which we call awareness training, all the way up to specialty training. And so it is really a menu of training options depending on your response capabilities. And so we've delivered that in Oregon, and we continue to work on plans to deliver more training. Attendees of the training have included anybody from law enforcement to public works to hazmat teams, tribal planners, and emergency planners. What we know is that it's not just about fire, that in terms of responding to a community incident, it really takes all of us. And so the planning and training has been delivered to all of those folks, and we'll continue to focus on that in the future. Director Phelps will be talking about the after action from Mosier, but one of the biggest things that we realized as a state is that additional training needs to occur at the state level, kind of bringing us all together, understanding the incident command structure, understanding our role in communication, and specifically certain areas, PIO and liaison officer. So our office put together a training plan that we'll be implementing over the next year to work on that piece. And moving forward, we want to put additional focus on the incident response planning, training, interagency coordination, and exercise plans as they're developed and refined. We want to encourage all levels of government to continue planning, and we hope to do that through our emergency planner, local, state, federal, tribal, and hazmat rail folks. And that's a plan that we'll be putting together over the next year, working with all of our response partners. One of the biggest things that we recommend is a full-scale exercise, and we talk a lot about exercise, but this is something that we want to make sure involves multi-jurisdictional, multi-discipline, and multi-agency. So what we know is that planning, training, and exercise are the key components to ensure a coordinated response. It's not just emergency responders. It's just not agencies. It takes all of us, rail planners, tribal planners, and emergency planners. So we just hope that the House bill and the work that we've done continues to work towards that efforts. Thank you.
Thanks. I just want to note, I got to try to keep us on schedule. We've got about 10 more minutes for your testimony and then another 5 minutes for questions. So as concise as you can be would be helpful. Thanks.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Power, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. I'm Andrew Phelps, Director of the Oregon Military Department's Office of Emergency Management, and I will keep my remarks brief. I will, though, provide an overview of the Mosher train derailment that occurred in June, on June 3rd, 2016, as well as some key points identified in the subsequent after-action report developed and documented by my office in close collaboration with several state agency partners. Shortly after noon on Friday, June 3rd, a Union Pacific Railroad unit train consisting of 94 tank cars containing Bakken crude oil derailed in the town of Mosher, Oregon. Initially, 16 train cars derailed, resulting in a release of product and subsequent fire. The fire initially involved one car and spread to two additional cars. This fire also spread to nearby vegetation, causing a small wildland fire. The incident required the combined efforts of local, tribal, state, federal, and private sector response resources under a unified command to bring under control and to effectively manage the incident response. Although the 16 derailed tank cars represented approximately 448,000 gallons of oil, only about 47,000 gallons of oil were lost. 13,000 gallons of that oil found its way into the wastewater treatment unit there in Mosher, 18,000 gallons seeped into the soil, and 16,000 gallons, it is estimated, burned off. Initial incident response came from the Mosher Fire Department, mutual aid from the Mid-Columbia Fire and Rescue District, and local and state law enforcement. Support also came from the United States Forest Service and the Oregon Department of Forestry, which arrived almost immediately after the derailment. Additional fire mutual aid resources and a state hazardous materials team were requested and immediately dispatched to the scene. And initial incident management actions included evacuations within the Mosher community, establishment of an incident command structure, traffic control, fire suppression, and the assessment of the hazardous materials risk to public health and safety. During the initial phase of the fire suppression operation, there were simultaneous operations taking place to prevent and contain the oil release and provide protection for endangered waterways. These included heavily booming adjacent dry creek beds, drainages, and the Columbia River. By 2:30 in the morning on Saturday, June 4th, all the fire that was impacting the rail cars and nearby vegetation had been extinguished. Incident management focus then shifted to actively monitoring health, continued public and community information and outreach, and facilitating the re-entry of those residents that had been evacuated. The formal after-action review began in July of 2016, although debriefs and what we call hot washes were conducted independently of this process immediately following the incident, and items captured via that process are included in this report that we released. Also, the report is available on our website, OEM's website, and I think most of the state agencies that are represented here today have links to our after-action report as well. The primary goal of the report was to identify key operational issues and understand the framework associated with the state emergency response coordination and incident management for the Mosher Rail incident, and to identify successes and, probably more importantly, opportunities for improvements associated with state agency response to the Mosher Rail incident. Again, our after-action review focused almost exclusively on the actions of state agencies. The state partners that helped develop the after-action report included the Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Transportation, Office of Emergency Management, the Office of the State Fire Marshal, the Oregon Health Authority, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and the Oregon State Police. As with any incidents, there were things that were identified as successes and things that were identified as areas to improve upon. Primarily, one of those first successes that we wanted to document was that there were no reported injuries or fatalities with this incident. Number one focus and priority for any emergency response is life safety, and we're happy to report that was achieved. State agency mobilization in response to the incident was expedient. Fire suppression efforts were effective, efficient, and well-supported. And environmental protective measures, including effective boom deployment environmental monitoring, product recovery, and other mitigation efforts were quickly implemented. Interagency coordination was generally effective and inclusive. Site monitoring and remediation efforts have been effective and continue to this day, and the ordering of fire mutual aid resources was also well coordinated. One of the more critical things that we try to document after an incident, aside from what we did right, was where we can improve upon future responses. Most of these overarching areas for improvement expand beyond oil train derailment and to the all hazards environment within which we work. Certainly enhanced coordination, command, and communications of situational calls among primary and supporting state agencies could be improved. There was a sense that information wasn't being well shared, especially among state agency leadership. A joint information system was activated, but a lack of coordination with incident command and sufficient staff to support the joint information system created confusion and a disconnect between public information officers at the site and the Joint Information Center. State agency executives and leaders need increased familiarity with the exposure to the management of information during incident responses. This can be facilitated through additional Joint Information Center and Joint Information System training, similar to what Deputy Fire Marshal Ruiz Temple mentioned. State agencies need a better understanding of their role within the Northwest Area Contingency Plan and increased familiarity with geographical response plans, state emergency operations plans, and emergency support function roles and responsibilities. And finally, state agencies could benefit from a better understanding of available resources like the Oregon State Fire Marshal Incident Management Teams and resource request process through incident command structures or through the Emergency Coordination Center. Again, this full report is available online on the Oregon Office of Emergency Management website. Thank you.
Right here. Good afternoon. Chairman Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Powers and Committee. My name is Dan Hamill. I am a division chief with Mid-Columbia Fire and Rescue, and on June 3rd, I was requested under a mutual aid request by Mosier Fire, arrived and took the position as the deputy IC of the incident that day. I'd like to make a note real quick is that prior to this incident, we locally had conducted an exercise April 20th. The Forest Service actually put together an exercise that almost mimicked that exact incident of a derailment that actually went into a wildland incident. So we had the opportunity to actually work with multi-agencies and multi-disciplines ranging from emergency responders to railroad individuals to get a good clue of just the complexity of this incident. Also, prior to this incident, we had taken the opportunity and sent firefighters to Pueblo, and coincidentally, on the day of the incident, two of my firefighters that had attended that training were on scene of that incident. I'd like to talk a little bit about what went well. What did go well is we had a half a mile evacuation within the first 30 to 60 minutes. We used countywide mutual aid agreements that we had from four different counties, three Oregon, including Hood River, Wasco, Sherman County, as well as Klickitat County across the river. We had the use of ODF and the Forest Service. I immediately had a temporary flight restriction over the area through Oregon Department of Forestry, as well as a Type 1 PIO public information officer through the Forest Service. Unfortunately, we had to wait for them to come out of Central Oregon. Other things is the use of the unified command. That was immediately recognized that we were going to have to put it into place, including all emergency responders as well as working to get liaisons from all the other private people involved. We did use the Conflagration Act at a time once we realized that we had a water source issue, as well as use of the state hazmat teams. I'm going to read a real brief. We had a local after action at one point, and through that, we identified areas of improvement. And this is the areas of improvement that we continue to see time after time in all risk hazards, specifically these ones that are of high risk and low incidence. Number one, communications. I cannot stress enough that communications is the number one failure in all our emergency incidents, ranging from our radio communications to just face-to-face communications. This is where the ICS training and having people involved really comes into effect. Unified command. Getting it organized in an emergency situation isn't as easy as we'd like to think it is. We're talking about law enforcement, fire, EMS, railroad in this particular incident and any other involved agencies. The importance of getting that out and having all people that potentially could be involved from any level an understanding of the importance and what their role could be, whether it's a liaison to the incident commander, so that we can more efficiently and quickly resolve. Training. It's been mentioned that the training, that is probably our number one thing that we can do to improve and get ready for the future. Whether it's a tabletop exercise to start with heads of agencies, like what we had, to the full field exercise. If we don't practice what we put in place and plan, we're not going to be able to effectively put everything in place. So we identified specifically that tabletop field exercise. It's been mentioned about the PIO and a joint information center, the importance of it. Yes, we had confusion. It would have been it was expected to happen, but we need to get more people involved in that. Those are positions that me as an emergency responder, I need to assign, but then once I've assigned it, I don't know what's going, you know, how they're dealing with that other than when they come and ask me for information. And then the ICS courses. We need to make sure that everybody's getting out there and staying up to date on them. Taking a class one time is not enough. If you don't practice it or use it, you will lose the skill. Fire, fortunately, has the benefit of using it on a daily basis. Our partners in law enforcement do a fairly good job. Unfortunately, they don't use it to that extent on a daily basis. That's why it's so important that we get the involvement and get the means so that we can run these incidents effectively. Other things for improvement, it's been mentioned, we have the Ask Rail app. My agency uses it extensively. We have started training on it for use in future incidents. Other things, as we look to the future, is other things of technology, whether it's some type of a way of keeping track of an incident, to better communications. I can only offer my experience with a similar type of program that we use for wildland, but something like that would help manage the incident and keep track of where people are. I'll conclude there and open it up for questions.
Okay. Well, committee, we've got maybe 5 minutes for questions. Hope that is sufficient. Does anybody have a question? Representative Holby.
Oh, thanks. I was just curious. I don't know if I didn't hear or what caused the derailment in Mosier, the trains to go off the track.
Chair Helm, Representative Holby. What happened on Mosier was what's called wide gauge. And essentially, the curve going into Mosier was held together not with typical railroad spikes, but with very, very long lag screws that had been broken a long time. But they weren't detectable because the shaft of that long lag screw extended through the plate and into the tie and was holding the rails on quite well. Something happened either with that train or a train that went through earlier, which was able to pry one of those plates off or somehow loosen it. And when that oil train came through, it just opened up the tracks like a zipper. To UP's credit, recognizing that was a defect that had been in place a long time and was not readily identifiable, they replaced that fastening system on every inch of track within the gorge and are currently, it's my understanding, replacing that fastening system across the state.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for being here. Really good testimony. Hal, a question for you. You mentioned talking about the criteria for the carriers providing ODOT with cargo and route information and the trigger for that. That's a train of a certain capacity. Is that correct?
Well, Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, there are a couple of different triggers. Under state law, we've asked the railroads to provide quarterly shipment information on everything that comes into the state, and that material is made available through a password-protected website that any first responder can access and use that for planning and training exercises just to know what's moving through the state. Federal law triggers notification of the CERC of the major unit trains, and that would be trains hauling 1 million gallons or more of crude. Okay. And then there are kind of a sub-notification on what we call those high hazardous flammable trains that is also under federal law. So there's a state law component and a federal law component.
Just to follow up. And then if you get that notification on the million gallons, you get the information, or does it go to Mariana, or is this just on a clearinghouse that everybody can access that information together?
It goes to Mariana, but I'll let her clarify.
Chair Hellam, Representative Johnson. So under the federal executive order, they're required to notify the CERC, which is our office. So we put that on our website. We created a rail page, and it also has links to ODOT.
Follow up. So, Mariana, thanks for your testimony. It's great. You told us, I think, trying to tell us, I think, the benefits of the bill we passed, House Bill 3225. Just briefly, could you talk about what the landscape on the day that the Mosier incident happened would have looked like had we not passed House Bill 3225 in the 15 session? Who would have been in charge? What kind of coordination might there have been or not been?
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, I'm not sure. I know that we always say incidents start local and end local, and so I feel confident in my fire chiefs that they would have done the response that they needed. But I think the biggest thing is coordinating all of those folks. And I was speaking with Chief Hamill earlier, and he said the benefit of the exercise and training is that you see people that you were not expecting to see. And I don't think he really understood the gravity of the situation in terms of planning until he saw and realized that it really takes all folks, from local to state to federal, tribal, everybody. And without the focus on planning, training, and exercise in that environment, you're not prepared to organize them, you're not prepared to manage them. And so although everything didn't go perfectly that day, the ability to meet and train with folks on April 20th, which was about 37-ish days before, is invaluable. So I would still be afraid to say what that would look like, but the day went well. There was a lot of luck in it, but a lot of planning and training that went into it as well.
One last question, Representative Holby.
Thank you. I'm just curious about the DOT 117 specs that start in 2018 and go through 2025. So there's a schedule of the percentage of cars that have to be replaced with this new type of car, and is that a per company a national statistic, or can we expect that each train will have a reduced percentage according to that schedule?
Chair Helm, Representative Holby, I can provide you the detailed schedule in terms of which cars of what vintage need to be replaced first. There's a whole range. Cars can remain in service for up to 50 years, and there aren't enough 117s that are constructed yet to replace entire fleets. The railroads don't own those cars. They're owned by the folks who are actually producing materials and shipping them. The railroads just haul them. So I can get that information to you in terms of the schedule.
Yeah. And just to be clear, that I was curious if that schedule applied per train.
And it does not. It applies per car. So they're replacing cars of certain age and configuration.
Gotcha.
Thank you both for the report and for your presentations today. It was very informative. Thanks again. All right, at this time I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2131. And I'm going to invite forward Representative Barbara Smith Warner and Senate President Peter Courtney.
Good afternoon, colleagues. I'm not sure if I'm starting before my esteemed colleague.
He's right here.
There he is.
Sit here.
Oh, you can sit here.
I want to sit in the middle.
All right. I'll move us both to the left.
Welcome, Mr. President.
You're first.
Okay. Good afternoon, colleagues, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Power, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I have the honor to represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. Everyone in this room probably remembers where they were when they heard about the oil train derailment in Mosier. On June 3rd, 2016, I was on my way to Central Oregon for the weekend to do a running relay, as a matter of fact, and I pulled over to get the details on the disaster that had befallen us. 16 cars derailed from the track and spilled 42,000 gallons of oil in one of our state's most scenic and sensitive areas. This was just the type of incident we had feared when I last came before this committee in 2015 with House Bill 3225. In the days after Mosher, I visited the site with House Speaker Tina Kotek and other electeds from around the state, including at least more than one of you on this panel today, and was able to talk to responders who were still on the ground from DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, the State Fire Marshal, Oregon Department of Transportation, Oregon Emergency Management, and the Washington Department of Ecology. It was abundantly clear that we had narrowly avoided a much worse disaster. Had the train derailed closer to the school, had the wind been blowing, had oil spilled directly into the Columbia River, or had the Washington Department of Ecology not come to our aid, the Mosher incident could have been an even more catastrophic disaster. Mosher demonstrated that, as we feared, and as I testified before this committee last year, oil train derailments and accidents are not an if, but a when. In 2015, the legislature in the state began planning for the when by passing funding House Bill 3225, as you've just heard from the state fire marshal and the information panel. We have made significant progress with our state's first responder training and emergency preparedness, both of which were crucial in our response to the Mosher incident. We need to maintain and expand this critical interagency work and training through the state fire marshal. Mosher also demonstrated, however, that we need to do more. House Bill 2131 and the Dash 2 amendments that you have before you today will build on our work with three critical elements. First, it will establish contingency planning along all routes where oil trains travel by adding them to the state's already existing oil or hazardous material spillage statutes. Second, it will require railroads to carry insurance coverage that will fully pay for a worst-case scenario spill. And finally, it will assess a fee on the rail carriers for the ongoing costs of emergency and contingency planning. Oh, who's coming in with us? There we go. Quite all right. That fee will be based on the number of high-hazard track miles operated in the state and will be divided between the Oil Spill Prevention Fund for DEQ and the Oil and Hazardous Material Transportation by Rail Action Fund for the State Fire Marshal. The contingency planning and insurance requirements will bring Oregon in line with requirements that Washington and California already impose on oil trains. Additionally, House Bill 2131 will involve the federally recognized tribes as partners in these efforts by calling them out specifically in statute for involvement in both emergency response training and in contingency plan review. No one likes the idea of 100 or more tank cars rolling at high speeds through the sensitive Columbia River Gorge or through the middle of our communities, whether it's a small rural town or highly populated area like North Portland. But we can't simply stop them at the state lines. Federal law and multiple articles of the U.S. Constitution prohibit it. What we can do is everything in our power to maximize safety and to be prepared, from emergency responder training to knowing the specific needs and sensitivities of every mile of track that runs high-hazard train cars through our state. I sit before you today on behalf of Speaker Kotek, side-by-side with President Courtney, and also with the support of Governor Brown, all of whom are greatly invested in this legislation, as well as the citizens of Oregon, who demand that we do everything we can to be prepared for the when, not if, of the next Mosher. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Senator, welcome. Go right ahead.
Is that my signal, Your Honor, that I proceed?
It is.
Thank you. Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, and Power, and members of the August House Committee on Energy and Environment. My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. And I'm here today to testify in support of the House Bill 2131. And I'm very nervous about this, as I will talk about just in a few seconds. You've already heard about the Mosher spill in detail by the Honorable Representative Barbara Eleanor Smith Warner. and a puncture in a tank car resulted in a 14-hour fire and the leaking of oil into the adjacent creek and the Columbia River. The train, I understand, originated in the great state of North Dakota. It was destined for the U.S. Oil and Refinery Company in Tacoma, Washington, our neighbor to the north. It had 94 tank cars loaded with what is called bacon crude oil. I had never heard of that before that disaster, but that is the oil that was in them. According to the oil lobbying group, American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, bacon crude is very volatile. It contains high levels of combustible gases compared to oil from other sources. The tank cars were, they call, the general purpose. I learned all this the hard way when I started to look into this some time ago. General purpose DOT 111 cars modified to CPC 1232 standards. Do not ask me anything about what I just said. But I know those numbers are accurate, and I know what I just said is accurate. They are referred to as jacketed 1232s. I call them knockoff or near double hold cars. Train cars are built today are called DOT 117s, which are stronger and safer than the 1232s. Experts say that had DOT 117s been in use, the oil spill that took place that day would not have, because the hulls would not have suffered a puncture. Some would like to ban oil trains in Oregon, and that, of course, is not possible, as good Representative Mintz knows why. Federal law won't allow us to do that. It's called the Interstate Commerce Clause. I would like to require the use of safer oil cars known as the DOT's 117s. That's why I started and got clobbered very quickly in those attempts, because federal law won't let us do that and has pushed the requirement for these new safer cars back until 2025. Therefore, Peter, you've got nowhere to go. Federal law will allow Oregon to require the contingency planning for oil train spills to make communities safer and to protect our environment. That is what we should do. Nothing is free, and the oil transporters should be required to contribute to the planning fund. I won't go into the specifics of what all this bill does. There are others here that can provide you that information. In fact, the person who worked with me long and hard on this is sitting to my right, Honor Braun, a lawyer in her own right, and also decides where all the bills that come to the Senate go. And she, along working with the Department of Justice staff, pretty much stopped me with every attempt I attempted to do, including go to court and file an injunction. And I'm still waiting for the State Department of Justice to come back and tell me why I can't do it, since they spent 2 hours in my office being very polite and told me they'd get right back to me. But that's life. I will answer your obvious question, as is, why is Peter Michael Coleman Courtney doing in front of this esteemed committee? I have a similar bill over in the Senate, which is on hold, Senate Bill 7. It's on hold because of you, in deference to this esteemed committee and to the incredible work of the extraordinary state representative to my right, your left, who's done so much more work on this bill than I have. My staff asked me to come testify on this bill since they are so closely related, my bill and this bill, and I said, no, I'm not going. Not going. I know better. Then the good representative from District 45 came to see me last week, the Honorable Barbara Eleanor Smith Warner. And let me tell you something. When Representative Barbara Eleanor Smith Warner wants you to do something, you do it. And so that is why I'm here today. Simple as that. Very nervous, but our bills are very similar. She is steeped in extraordinary knowledge in this area, has worked long and hard, much longer than I have. We're not talking just about Mosier. We're talking about trains that come through my area, a lot of different areas. And I'll leave it up to you and your individual collective wisdom as to what you feel about this legislation. But I do think that a lot of work has gone into it. And the Senate awaits your efforts to see where you want to go with your individual and collective wisdom. And I'm grateful that you would allow me to come here today, even though, as I said, I don't think I'm a volunteer. I was conscripted by the Representative Smith-Moore. Thank you, Honor, for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Do we have questions for the sponsors of this bill? I guess I would. Representative Johnson.
With great trepidation, I might add. But I'll direct my question to the expert, if that's okay.
Thank you. I never did think I was much of an expert. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, question related to what we heard previously from the State Office of State Fire Marshal and your point number one of contingency planning. And in your bill, it talks about a contingency plan for a high-hazard train route to be submitted to the department. I think you're referring to DEQ. Is that correct?
Yes, that is who, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. That is the current statutes which cover oil that is transported by other means. That is where they go through. And so that is indeed where this would be added into.
My follow-up would be, I guess, based on what we just heard with the collaboration between the track oversight from ODOT, the contingency plans, management, and so forth from OSM, why would we want to bring DEQ into the role of overseeing or pronouncing, you know, making determinations about the qualifications of a contingency plan?
Sure. Thank you for the question, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson. A couple things. As I mentioned, there's actually, I believe that DEQ has put into OLIS a fact sheet about oil and hazardous material spill response preparedness training that gives a lot of specifics about how they have done it already under current statute that's been in place for, I believe, close to 20 years. And this bill would basically define high hazard trail routes and then high hazard trail routes and include those trains into the definition that would be covered by this preparedness. In the language in our bill specifically, we call out collaboration with the state fire marshal on the training elements, and the regular the contingency planning process is very clearly laid out in statute and has been successfully done, as I said, for the last almost 20 years. And so this would merely be the another contingency plan that would go in. And in our language, we do call out consultation with the fire marshal on the training and with a number of other folks, as I mentioned, with federally recognized tribes on the emergency response, as well as being able to play a role in the already prescribed procedures for reviewing those contingency plans.
Well, I guess we can continue to talk about that, but I guess I would just hope that we could factor in the world post 3225 and what we've learned from that.
Yep.
And not just go back to the sum total maybe 20 years prior, where, as we saw on the chart, you know, the cargo wasn't even an issue 20 years ago. I think we've learned a tremendous amount since that time. Secondly, I would just ask about your fees implementation. You say California and Washington have done this to some degree, but California and Washington are also destinations for the cargo.
True.
How do you perceive doing this in a way that's going to be constitutionally doable and legally defendable?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Johnson, couple things. Number one, indeed, this has been an issue in the state on the fee assessment for a while because we are a through state. We're not a destination, and so it is challenging. The idea of the track assessment and division is one that we came up with 2 years ago, and because we ended up moving in a pretty different direction, we never kind of got all the way through that. I have enjoyed a great working relationship with the railroads, particularly you. On this so far, and look forward to having continued vigorous and productive conversations with them on getting to a point either with this particular assessment method or another method that we can use to fund this. And just to go back to your comment about emergency management and not losing the progress we've made in 3225, I could not agree with you more. I worked closely with the fire marshal on this language and said specifically, I know we had talked a little bit about that, and I went specifically to them and said, I don't want this to roll back any progress that we've made. And they assured me that it did not. They work very closely with them and other agencies already, and that this would strengthen their abilities statutorily to be able to continue to do that. So thank you.
Any further questions?
Actually, I have one quick one.
Representative Power.
I'm looking at the timeline that League of Oregon Cities provided with what happened in Mosier. And I'm wondering how the timeline for incidents response, you know, be on site within 1 hour, have the within 3 hours, there's another step for containment. And then, again, I think within 8 hours, have a sort of larger system-wide response. Can you talk me through how that would have happened in Mosier, whether that improves upon too much?
Yes.
Okay. I thought you were an expert. So
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Power, indeed, I would defer. I feel a little bit like Mariana from the fire marshal, who said when asked about how do you think this would have happened if 3225 hadn't been in effect and wasn't able to answer. I'm not entirely sure. That's a great question. I'd be happy to work through that. I don't think I can't do it off the top of my head, but I would be happy to kind of work through comparing what this would do versus how it responded, how the response happened in Mosier. Can I offer you that?
And that would be great.
And send it back to you.
Very conveniently.
I was going to say, I'll throw a paper airplane over our wall divider.
Okay. Paper
airplane. Thank you very much, Mr. Senate President and Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you all.
And next is Carmen Four from the governor's office.
Go right ahead when you're ready.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chairman Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Power, and members of the committee. My name is Carmen Four, and I'm the Senior Director for Federal Affairs and Transportation for Governor Kate Brown. Thank you for allowing me to speak today before you on this important topic of rail safety, and I would also say to Representative Barbara Smith Warner for also calling me and strongly encouraging me to speak before you all this afternoon. My purpose here is to maybe give you a little bit of a bigger step or a background about how we got to where we are today as it relates to rail safety in Oregon. Since 2014, the state of Oregon has worked diligently to strengthen the safe movement of hazardous materials by rail. Around that time, there was an increased awareness that the volume of crude moving on our nation's rail network had dramatically increased due to newer drilling technologies, which unlocked previously unreachable oil in the U.S. Bakken Formation, the Permian Basin, and the Canadian oil sands. This production increase in North America was so significant that it caused a shift in how oil was transported to refineries within the United States. Today, oil shipment by rail, along with ethanol and biodiesel, are relatively flat. You know, we're not seeing quite the same spikes that we had seen a few years ago. Even so, the shift to move liquid fuel produced in the center of the continent by rail to refineries located in the coastal regions, like the Gulf Coast, as well as along the West Coast in Oregon and in Washington, and how we respond to that shift remains a priority here in Oregon. Increased rail shipments and several major spills, including the notable disaster in Lac-Mégantic, Canada, and last year's spill in Mosier, Oregon, have raised serious concerns here about how the shipment of crude oil by rail transpires and how do we respond to a potential accident. For example, is it safe? Are local emergency responders prepared to respond to this type of an incident? How would an accident impact a community or an environmentally sensitive area? Are the railroads doing all that they can to prepare for an event or an accident? Are federal and state regulators doing all they can to oversee the safe transport of crude by rail and other hazardous material? Now, so you know, Oregon has been working diligently at all levels to strongly advocate for increased rail safety. At the federal level, we've advocated for comprehensive rules to reduce train speeds and strengthen tank car standards. This has included reaching out to committees in Congress to request that we hasten legislative timelines for the transition to safer tank cars, much of like what is currently being done in Canada today. We've advocated for comprehensive rail safety plans that are subject to approval by the Federal Railroad Administration to ensure emergency responders know what personnel and equipment are available to them and how to handle them during a worst-case discharge. We have supported the implementation of positive train control to improve safety of freight and passenger trains running here in Oregon and across the country. And we've requested guidance from the Federal Rail Administration that states like Oregon that participate in the State Safety Participation Program have guidance on the appropriate number of track safety inspectors in states where we do see an increased movement of hazardous materials by rail. Now, within Oregon, we've advocated for the notification to emergency responders about the movement of hazardous materials by rail in communities, so those responders have the information they need in a timely manner without having to request it. We've requested state agencies proactively identify and propose changes to outdated statutes, administrative rules, and procedures related to rail safety. We've increased the number of rail staff to conduct hazardous materials and safety inspections. We've requested the railroads set up and improve a well-tested mechanism for emergency responders to access train manifests on train cargo so they can access that in the event of a rail derailment. There have been incidents in the past, presented by the National Transportation Safety Board, that the inability to access those train manifests has had an ability to know what's on, you know, what's where there's an accident and how those emergency responders engage on scene. Now, new resources for emergency response in Oregon, you all have led the way. The governor's office had requested, and this legislature and the railroads responded 2 years ago to increase resources dedicated to emergency response planning, equipment purchase, training, and exercises, and that really is very much appreciated and made a difference. What is certainly true that is that in the wake of the incident, and the after-action report in response to the accident in Mosier is that we need to continue the work to increase all aspects of rail safety here in Oregon. From the outset of this work, we share the perspective in our office of then-outgoing NTSB Chairman Deborah Hirschman when she said in her farewell speech that U.S. communities were not prepared to respond adequately to worst-case accidents involving trains carrying crude oil and ethanol, that federal regulators were behind the curve in addressing the transport of hazardous liquids by rail, given the dramatic increase in the movement of oil and other flammable material by train, and that the petroleum industry and emergency responders didn't have the provision in place to address worst-case scenario in the event of trains carrying crude or ethanol. We've made great strides here in Oregon to turn the situ around and have had support of this body's work in the past to continue strengthening this effort. The governor has encouraged that there's legislation before you for you to weigh, to hear from communities, and to continue with ensuring we're doing the right type of planning and the right type of training to shore up rail safety here in Oregon. From my experience, what I have found is that local communities, you, your colleagues, railroad staff, our federal delegation, everybody very much cares about rail safety response. And where we have taken the position is that we will advocate vociferously to the federal government to shore up rail standards where appropriate and work in partnership with you all and the railroads where resources are needed to be brought to bear to do those responsibilities that we have on the state side. So with that, on behalf of the governor, I want to thank you for hearing this bill today, for hearing from Oregonians across the state, and for your continued leadership and support of rail safety.
Thank you.
Questions for Carmen?
Thank you very much.
And at this time, I'll call forward Chairman Eugene Austin Green, Jr. from the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, Chairman Gary Burke, Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla, Tribal Council Member Raymond Estrada, Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakima Nation, and Karen Jim Whitford, of the who is a Celilo Village Elder. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for traveling to the state capitol to testify today. Whoever's ready can go first.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Helm and members of the Energy and Environmental Committee. My name is Eugene Austin Green, Jr., and I am the chairman of the Tribal Council for the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. My testimony today is in favor of House Bill 2131 to provide for adequate fees and coverages to address spills from rail cars that could injure salmon streams crucial to our way of life. Thank you for hearing this important bill. our people today, as did our ancestors, live on fish from the Intiwana to the Warm Springs and Wemus to the Wasco people, which our ancestors named the Columbia River. We have also lived in and fished in the Towarna High Hooks, which the Hudson Bay men called the Deschutes, the Matolius, John Day, Hood, and Willamette Rivers, and 15 Mile and Willow Creek since time immemorial. Our people continue to exercise our treaty fishing rights on these rivers. The Creator gave our people the awesome responsibility of caring for all of our lands and waters, including rivers on which we exercise treaty rights under the Treaty of Middle Oregon of 1855. We have not always been able to protect our waters. You know well that one of our greatest gifts, Celilo, Great Falls of the Columbia, lies buried under water backed up behind the Dalles Dam. Through the ages, this was the Wall Street of the Oregon country, where tribes gathered from all around the Northwest to trade and celebrate the riches of the Big River. The silence of the thundering heart of the Oregon by our forebears broke the hearts of many of our elders. The damage done to our people and the river from this one tragic act is beyond words. Now we face yet another threat from your people along the Columbia, and it's the largest remaining waterfall where we fish in our treaty-ceded area, Shears Falls, on the Deschutes River. We have fought since time immemorial and have used our treaty rights and other rights to protect the great salmon runs of the Columbia, and we are starting to see recovery of salmon fisheries that many Oregonians had written off as lost. An example of our efforts in the multi-million dollar fish passage project at Round Butte Dam, which we jointly funded with Portland General Electric and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. This project involved construction of a unique water tower structure that enables downstream passage of juvenile fish and returns adult Chinook and sockeye salmon as well as steelhead to the Matolius, Crooked, and Upper Deschutes rivers. Now we work to preserve and revive the lamprey population that has provided important food for our people. There were so many lamprey at the close of the 20th century, we did not think we could be reduced to too few for our basic needs. We do not understand yet all of the causes for the collapse of the Columbia River lamprey, but we know that the passage of mortality at the Big Dam is an important one. We are studying the movement at the dams to design better lamprey bypasses during this century. There have been hazardous material spills from truck accidents on I-84 that have decimated runs. Now the rivers of Oregon come seemingly endless trains filled with crude oil from North Dakota. They roll across every river in our treaty-ceded area, and they roll along our reservations, looming over the fishers still dip netting at the Shears Falls, as our people have for countless centuries. The rail cars are not modern. They are not built to survive derailment. We saw this in the Mosier event last year. Just a mile in either direction, and that train would have sent flames roaring through the Columbia Gorge forest and through the town. Critically, the fish, it would have sent oil into the river, which adds to the stress on salmon swimming towards the third mighty dam on their final journey home. We were smiled upon that day, but as our fishers see the oil trains loom over them at Shears Falls, they wonder when the next train will fall and who will stop this poison from coursing down our rivers. Who here believes that trains are the way to move large amounts of oil? Is there any among you who question the only safe way to move oil is in pipelines just because the oilmen have not quite figured out how to build a North Dakota pipeline? We and our gifts from the Creator must face fire and destruction. It is clear to us, and it should be clear to this committee, that all all of our work to rebuild healthy, naturally spawning salmon runs and bring back lamprey on Oregon's rivers must not be risked for these dangerous trains. We know that the railroads have improved track maintenance in Oregon and on the Washington shore of the Columbia after the Mosier wreck. We are thankful for it, and we pray that it will be enough. But we have not forgotten that the tracks and cars are kept up by men and the trains are run by men. And the oil train disasters in the United States and Canada were caused by errors of men. We understand that the railroads are under national jurisdiction, and we know that means we are left to seek solutions with our neighbors and sister governments. Sad to say, there is little even the Legislative Assembly can do to protect our great state from the lack of foresight that gave us this role in danger. Still, House Bill 2131 would give all of our first responders a fighting chance to contain a disastrous spill and fire in our ancient and blessed home. It would guarantee enough resources from those who reap the benefits of the oil traffic to repair the damage of the next oil train wreck to the extent it can be repaired. You have the power to prepare firefighters, technicians, and scientists to save our rivers from further harm. After the big dams, Hanford's pollution, and habitat loss, we do not know how much more battering the fish can take. It takes time. It takes time to every precaution to protect our rivers and passage of House Bill 2131 to help do that. For the people of the Warm Springs tribes and the fish who symbolize the greatness of Oregon, I urge you to act swiftly. Thank you for considering this bill and for the opportunity to address you. I'd also like to add that there are 31 in-lieu fishing sites along the Columbia River as well that are deeply impacted by rail traffic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Good afternoon. My name is Gary Burke. I'm a board chairman of the Confederate Tribes Umatilla Indian Reservation, and we support HB 2131. There are tens of millions of gallons of Bakken crude oil and other crude oil shipped along the Columbia through the gorge and up the Deschutes River every week. In Mosier, the Union Pacific derailment got a lot of attention last year, but there have been many others. This year, on January 9th, a Union Pacific train derailed on the reservation. Last winter, a BNSF train struck a rock along the Deschutes River and caused a diesel spill from the engine. In early 2015, a UP train derailed near Meacham Creek, close to our reservation. In the fall of 2014, a BNSF train struck a rock near Pasco along the Columbia River and leaked over 1,000 gallons of diesel. And during that summer, a UP train derailed and five rail cars slid into the Columbia River. Skilled oversight is vital to make sure that the right parties are consulted and standards are met after a spill. Right now, DEQ spill response money comes from many sources with no general fund dollars. But stable funding is needed to address spills that could be catastrophic. The assessment levy in Section 14 of the bill provides an important funding source. The contingency planning in the bill is important as well. We believe tribes should have the ability to review those plans, and we appreciate the amendment proposed to do this. The tribes have long-term experience managing waterways and can offer valuable information to state agencies. In closing, we encourage you to provide for more statewide response staff. The governor budget has an added $3 million for spill response. We need this and more because the personnel numbers have not kept up with the incidents, that there are no personnel in Northeast Oregon. Thank you again for this time to testify on behalf of the Confederate Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation. 12th Statute Point 945 ratified and proclaimed today.
Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
If you can back off of the microphone,
oh,
it'll actually
right
work
there?
Better. Even further.
Further, yeah.
Right there?
Yeah.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Karen Jim Whitford. I am an elder of the Tsleil-Waututh Village. My name is Lynn Tux, and I am, my people are called the Wayampums, and I am enrolled Yakima tribal member, but I am also one of the elders of Tsleil. And one thing I'd like to say to the public here and you, in my whole lifetime, I've known Oregon to be a love for environment, as the Native Americans are across the nation. But I feel very strong about Oregon. And my father, who was a chief of the Columbia River, was very strong on this. And he traveled worldwide also to represent our people. And he has, he's deceased now. But I'd like to give a word that affected the Native Americans across the United States, especially when the dams were made. The Indians heard the word progress, and it was a very fearful word to hear because of the dams being made, the highways, the airports. There was many things that affected the Native Americans across the United States. And the railroads came in, the barges came, and when the railroads came, it's like the old Western movies. It's like you see the railroad companies bullying the people of the land and the Native Americans. But today it's in a different way. And the Native Americans have witnessed this centuries now. We don't know what they all carry. We fought against it in Washington State, carrying the garbage to the landfill called Rabanco at one time. And we had to educate ourselves on the effect of garbage. Now we have to educate ourselves on the what's going to affect us from oil or any plant or anything that touches the water. Also, the barges. At one time, we were affected by the Hanford things that were carried along the river. And no matter which way, it's not only the Native Americans, it's also the towns and little communities along the Columbia River that are affected. You're affected by railroads, highways, and barges. And from here to that wall, that's how close the train is to my village. And in our village, we only have one exit for safety. If we ever had a fire hazard, and if we're affected in an emergency, or if we have a spill from the railroad track, we only have one exit. And when I think about this thing that happened in Mosier, I thought about my village. I only seen one exit onto the highway. Where did these people go? In our village, we kept trying to ask the government and the tribes and anywhere, could they make another exit for our village? And that's a hazard to us. You name any kind of progress, it affects my village. And same way with the railroad. I have relatives that work for the railroad, and we're not told about what they spray on the railroad. My brothers and my sisters were saying it's a hazardous smell. There's a lot of things that need to be done and studied for the protection of not just Native Americans, but for the public, the land, and the wildlife. What affects in that water is very deadly to our fish. Also, anything that happens on a highway, we're always blocked in. We had a crime thing happen on our village, and we were blocked in. Any kind of emergency, it affects us. And to hear about the oil being transferred, they go through my village late at night. Usually a horn will blow four times, but at nighttime it's quiet. Very quiet. You don't hear a sound. And I witnessed this year round. And I always wonder, is there a fine or anything for them if, you know, we got harmed or anything? And with all these things to hear about, you know, like I'm saying about progress with oil or any kind of chemical, what happened to Valdez? Why was there ever a study not shown to the public the effect of an oil spill before it even goes through a community? Health-wise, land-wise, wildlife, you name it. And also, you know, if there was some kind of a study in for anything to go on further with any railroad company or highway or barges, I'd like to see safety done. Because Oregon State is well known for its love for environment. And I witnessed the Hanford, the effects. I was able to go to the studies and to the meetings with the 16 scientists that declassified, classified documents. The barges, I don't know what the effects are with the public information that they give. I don't know any information what a train carries, but I know when it's quiet that there's something strange going on. And living my lifetime in Celilo, along the river, it's very hard to not notice. And when we have a disaster, mind you, my reservation, where I am registered at, each one of the reservations is 100 miles apart from us. And when we have a disaster, we can't get the help from the Dalles, from state or county, right away when we have a disaster there. So we have to call the tribes. And the response, can you imagine how to drive 100 miles an hour? But it's not only the Celilo village, it's also towns like Mosier, or little communities that are close to the water and railroad. And we've been affected by different other things. And
Ms. Whitford?
I'd just like to remind you, too, also, with the tribes here, I want to thank you for being here. Under our treaty, we're supposed to have protection for unusual and custom places. We're supposed to have protection for our land. We're supposed to have protection for our resources. We're supposed to have protection for our water and our health. And these are rights given to us in our treaties. I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Right ahead.
Nick Bachway, in me naimuma, Wanishash, Kutsiatsak, and Kutswichs. Mr. Chairman Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, and Vice Chair Power, and members of the committee, my name is Raymond Estrada, and I am an elected official of the General Council, not the Tribal Council. Just to make that correction, it's been done twice today. I'm not here to represent my tribe. I'm here to represent my Indian village and our leader, Chief Olson Mianis Jr., who is the chief of the Columbia River area and Celilo Village. We requested permission from him to be here on his behalf, as we just lost a leader, our sub-chief, so he didn't want to make a public appearance. Today, I came here to talk on my people, but after seeing the reports and hearing how people are talking about, all we're doing here today is preparing for a disaster. The federal government is telling us it's okay for us to prepare for a disaster. not to prevent disasters. We're preparing for a future loss of life, future loss of environment, not just human life. You know, our land, our water, our animals, they're all affected by this. Once you change a habitat, you can't get it back. We try to make things better, but we can't. We're taught that our land is best left alone, best left the way it is. We have historical monuments that are not publicized because they have traditional value, that increased train cars and oil train cars, of any kind of train cars, shake the land, and they shake those monuments that are standing on the cliffs high. And I'm worried that the increased increased trains on the rail will eventually get rid of some of those historical artifacts that cannot be moved or taken, and they'll be taken from us. And there's no kind of compensation for losing something of that value. And to lose a brother so important to us as the salmon. A long time ago, we would hear stories growing up about this, how tough our salmon were, because they had to jump the Celilo Falls. But if you notice now, our salmon are 20 pounds lighter. They're weak. We broke them a long time ago. And we're, as Indian people, are charged to be stewards of the land and to protect something that we, that gave its life for us. The salmon stood up and said that he will be our food when the first people were created. He was the first one to stand up to be our nourishment for our bodies. And that's why we respect him so much. And it's really hard for me to sit here and try to talk to you about protecting something when all we're doing is preparing for future disasters here. You know, when we seen the slide, it says, well, there was only 14 derailments, but it doesn't say how many people, how many lives were lost by being hit by trains. Increased traffic. Our fishermen in Celilo have to go across three tracks to get to the fish access site. And sometimes they make that trip 6 to 7 times a day. So every time they go across that, they're putting themselves at risk. And now you want to increase traffic in our area, which is by the train bridge in Celilo, where all the trains have to stop and block our one entrance to Celilo Village and our one exit. And it's not an overpass or an underpass. It's right over the road. And now you want to increase these mile-long, sometimes longer, when they have different cars in them, trains that are going to block our... We have a lot of elders that need medical care, and an emergency response team wouldn't be able to get there. They wouldn't be able to access the village because on one side is swamp and on the other side is a cliff. But I wanted to come here to speak on behalf of that and our people, because just like this last spring, this last summer, we had a fire, and it was hard to get any emergency response. I hear them talk about emergency response, but when we ask for help, we have to ask from our tribe. And like she said, they're an hour or more away. It's hard to get response in their area. And nobody's came to teach us how to protect ourselves from a potential oil spill or oil fire. But the only thing that protects my daughter from the railroad tracks is a barbed wire fence. And the track is 50 feet behind my house. And my daughter's 4 years old, and I don't want to lose her to those tracks, and none of my family. And we've lost a lot of people to the tracks. But that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you all. Any questions, committee? Thanks again for traveling today, and thanks for your thoughtful testimony. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman.
I'm going to skip over and get these guys. At this time, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3344. And the public hearing on House Bill 2131 is also still open. But I want to make sure to go ahead and get the folks that want to present on 3344, at least the initial folks heard today. So I'll invite forward Arlene Burns, Peter Corneliuson, Lisa Beatty, and Jim Appleton. Brad's in back. And Brad is here, right?
I do. He doesn't want to come up.
Oh. You go first. All right. Okay. No. His former involvement in this column.
Shall we begin?
Go right ahead when you're ready.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Helm and Vice Chairmen and all the committee. My name is Arlene Burns. I'm the mayor of Mosier. Our tiny town was nearly wiped off the map 9 months ago when a unit train of Bakken crew derailed within our city limits. Four cars ruptured, causing a fire that could have devastated our community if not for a rare windless day in the Columbia River Gorge. If the winds had been typical, as they were every other day of that month of June, our town most likely would have been lost, especially if the mile of cars still connected to the burning derailed cars got too hot and caused a bleve, a boiling liquid expanded vapor explosion like the one in Quebec that killed 47. Seven of those 47 were vaporized. Our town and both directions of the freeway were considered inside the blast zone. Our region is now much more aware of the vulnerabilities and what is at stake. The Mosier derailment is one of the motivating factors for the Oregon legislature to introduce the Mosier Act, HB 2131, as well as HB 3344. Oregon urgently needs to update and upgrade our ability to plan for and to respond to derailments like the one we experienced. HB 2131 does this in several ways. First, it requires planning. If the train had derailed just upstream or just downstream of Mosier in 2016, the oil could have been discharged directly into the Columbia River, or it could have ignited nearby homes. HB 2131 compels the railroad to develop plans for sensitive resources and work with agencies to be ready should something terrible happen. This is common sense. Second, HB 2131 helps to build Oregon's Oil Spill Prevention Fund. Oregon is behind its neighbors in California and Washington in ensuring that railroads pay their fair share to address the risk introduced by oil trains. Lastly, HB 2131 requires railroads to show that they have the financial capability to address a worst-case oil train derailment. This common-sense measure will help ensure that railroads are shouldering the liability of the risk that we are facing in towns like Mosier. Mosier was far from a worst-case event. In fact, in many respects, we were lucky. Lucky that the wind wasn't blowing. That the water we needed for fire suppression was made available, and that we were able to keep people out of harm's way. Despite all this, months later, our groundwater remains contaminated, and residents shudder each time an oil train rolls through our town. I'm convinced that no level of oil trains are truly safe, and the Oregon legislature should ensure that we have the tools to evaluate the terminals that generate oil train traffic. HB 3344 is a big step in this regard. In Mosier, our motto is small enough to make a difference, and I like to think that part of the reason that we were so lucky, and we were, was that we can help make a difference in the larger conversation, ensuring that Oregon is proactive in defining and sculpting our future. House Bills 2131 and 3344 are meaningful steps towards protecting all of the communities along the tracks. Thank you.
Go right ahead, whoever's ready.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, and Power, members of the committee. My name is Peter Cornelison. I'm a Hood River City Council member. And both the city and the county of Hood River have taken the unusual step of writing Representative Mark Johnson and this committee in support of House Bill 2131. It's because we think it's that important. That's because we realize in Hood River that we're playing a sort of railroad roulette in the Columbia Gorge. Hood River is only 7 miles west of our sister city of Mosier, and when this accident happened there, it was a wake-up call for the entire gorge, us, and I think the state. Mosier was the 36th oil train accident in North America since 2013. The LA Times found that 39% of these accidents were due to track failure, as Mr. Gard said, as was the case for the poorly maintained Union Pacific track through Mosier. While 39% of these accidents are due to wheel problems, human error, and collisions. The fact is, accidents are going to happen, especially with oil trains. The average speed of these trains, these trains that had accidents, was 34 miles per hour. Even with the new safety standards promulgated by the federal government, which the railroads fought vociferously, using thicker steel and better fittings, these tank cars are still subject to puncture and ignition at speeds over 12.3 miles per hour. As we've heard, federal laws won't allow Oregon to say no to oil trains, but we can make them safer. That's what House Bill 3121 does. Similarly, we need to bolster Oregon's ability to review and deny oil by rail terminals by passing House Bill 3344. That would increase scrutiny of oil by rail terminals, remove loopholes, and prohibit state transportation funding by oil by rail terminals. Both bills contain significant common sense steps to address oil terminals and oil train safety in Oregon. The U.S. demand for oil is shrinking thanks to fewer miles being driven and more fuel-efficient cars. We need to transition away from fossil fuels to clean energy. Please pass these two bills as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Not too close. Chairman Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Power, it's my pleasure to appear before you. My name is Lisa Beatty. I'm the Council President of the Milwaukee City Council. We only learned about this hearing on Friday, and so I'm at this point only appearing on my own behalf and not on behalf of the whole council, but I feel fairly certain that our council will pass a resolution or send a letter in support of both bills as they go forward. I think a point's been made here. I won't repeat everything that Mayor Burns and Councillor Cornelison said. I think they covered things very well. I think points have been made here, but maybe not strongly enough, that lest the railroads or other interests make you think that these bills are far-reaching, I think we're playing catch-up. We're playing catch-up with Washington and California here, and I think, you know, there should be no question that these are the good steps to take. As Representative Smith Warner said, it's a not if but a when. We know, even though ODOT's safety regime has reduced the number of derailments, they still happen. You know, they could happen in a more populous area. That, you know, we've been lucky so far in some of the things that have happened, but we could have a big disaster coming. I guess I would like to comment on a couple of things in the specifics of the bills. Well, first off, I think a lot of Oregonians think that the trains just come through the gorge and turn into Washington, and that's not true, as we saw in the mapping that ODOT gave us at the start. The trains are going through all parts of the state, so I think cities like Milwaukee, I mean, they go south through Milwaukee, through Oregon City, through Salem, through on down through Klamath Falls, through Eugene. I hope that more cities will start paying attention to this issue and not think it's just the gorges issue, because it's really a statewide issue. A couple of things about the bill. I just encourage you to think about framing it not just being about oil, but as we saw last week, an ethanol train derailed in Iowa and burnt for two or three days. I actually, in reading about that, I learned that in the last decade, an estimated 2 million gallons of ethanol have leaked from train derailments across this country. So there are other substances that are hazardous. They're not all created alike, and we know that about the crude oil, even that the Bakken crude is the most volatile because the producers won't undergo a step of refinement at the site before they ship it that would make it far less volatile. So that gets me to my main point, which was the insurance regime in the draft in HB 2131. I found it very confusing. As a lawyer, I know that the more confusing something is, the better it is easy for lawyers to pick apart. And I wonder if it wouldn't be preferable to consider a more streamlined sort of insurance requirement. It seems to me there are three sort of categories of things that we could incentivize or disincentivize by the way the insurance requirement is structured. The type of the substance, and again, that difference between the ultra-volatile Bakken crude and other crude and ethanol, the quantity of the substance, and the type of the rail car. And could we use insurance as a way to incentivize a faster replacement of the DOT 111 rail cars? So those are just some things I wanted to suggest as you contemplate the fine-tuning that you'll be doing on this bill, but I'm wholly in support of moving forward with both bills. Thank you.
Good afternoon, representatives. My name is Jim Appleton. I'm the fire chief in Mosier. I'm not a rail safety expert. I'm not a hazmat expert, but I am the risk management professional for the town that we've all been talking about this afternoon. So it's in that capacity and representing my constituents that I'm here speaking in favor of 2131. Very emphatically, and I want to echo the words of the governor's representative that this is everything possible to be done to limit the effects of these incidents really should be your objective, and that's the simple message that I bring as, again, the representative of my constituents. It's no secret that my ultimate response to oil by rail is that it's nuts and that it should be banned. This is obviously not the forum to litigate that, but I welcome Mr. Estrada's comment to the same effect. The one thing that I would say, again, in representing my constituents, and I'm a fire district. I'm not just the city of Mosier, but 22 square miles of pretty well settled interface properties around. The one thing that I would say is echoing the word that's come up many times before here of communities. There's a lot of environmental standards in this bill. There's a lot about DEQ and readiness in terms of an environmental response. Communities is really the issue. We're the front line. We're the first responders. We're the ones that are most at risk, and that's where the value that you should be protecting is located. In closing, I wanted to just respond to Representative Johnson's question about DEQ. My experience on the Mosier derailment shows that DEQ and the state fire marshal do a completely different type of contingency planning, and what DEQ did was completely vital in a way that I hope you can appreciate. I'm not an expert at that, but I can tell you that boots on the ground, that was such an important element to have Mike Renz and the resources and experience that he brought and the preparation that came before that. So I think we need to strengthen every part of our responses, not just the exercises and preparedness and training, but also the level of planning that DEQ brings to it. So I'll close there. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Thank you so much for being here and providing your testimony. We appreciate it. At this point, folks, the allotted time for the committee meeting is passing, so I think some of my colleagues are probably going to be picking up and going on with the rest of their evening, but I'll be staying, and we're a good ways through the number of folks that have signed up to testify. I'm going to get back to grabbing some folks that are more than 100 miles away at the moment, and then we'll continue. I wanted to get Laurent Picard, Holly Wood, Dr. Maria McCormick.
Lichtenthaler?
Yeah, and Eric Lichtenthaler, if Eric's here. Very good.
Hi.
welcome, and whoever's ready to jump in, go right ahead.
I'll go ahead and jump in. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Helm and committee members. My name is Polly Wood, and I have been on the board of directors of Friends of the Columbia River Gorge and the Hood River Valley Residents Committee for the past 8 years. And I'm a resident of Hood River and live near the historic Columbia River Highway. I'm a constituent of Representative Mark Johnson, and my long involvement in these conservation groups, my daughter's school, and the community have made me appreciate how connected and how fragile are all the pieces that make up a great community. The rail line is a thread that weaves through every aspect of our community. Depending upon its cargo, it is a thread that can bind or unravel all we care about. I support House Bill 2131 because it creates more accountability for the railroads that failed to protect Mosier last summer when their track failed and their oil train derailed, caught fire, and spilled 42,000 gallons of oil. As a mother of an elementary school-aged child who has many friends at the Mosier School, it chills my blood to know how close those children and their community came to be incinerated, like those 47 people in Canada, were it not for that rare windless day in June. So many of those children walked to school on a trail next to where the train derailed. Still, Mosier children were very traumatized by their evacuation to the Dalles, where many of them waited late into the night as parents were notified and families reconnected. Then, with no contingency plan, the school year was simply over, leaving the kids hanging academically, socially, and emotionally, and leaving parents scrambling to juggle work schedules and arrange unforeseen supervision for their children. It's frightening enough to know that residents along any part of this rail line are exposed to such risk with each and every high-hazard train that passes. The railroads must do the right thing by these companies and have contingency plans and training for oil trains related spills in place, pay fees to build Oregon Spill Contingency Fund, and have adequate insurance to cover worst-case oil train derailments. Oregon has the weakest laws on the West Coast related to oil trains and terminals. So I also support House Bill 3344, which would remove the loophole that allows oil terminals to be built on state waterways without review and prohibit state transportation funding for oil by rail terminal infrastructure. I urge you to support House Bill 2131 and 3344 because they're at the heart of why you represent us. The health and well-being of our communities, our children, our waterways, the precious gorge environment, and our local economies that are all at risk from the inherently unsafe transport of oil by rail. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Chair Helm, and greetings, Vice Chairs Johnson and Powers. Thank you for, and other committee members, thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Laurent Picard, and I've been a Hood River resident for 19 years, and I served on the Hood River City Council for over 10 years. I currently work as a Portland Fire Lieutenant, and I've been with Portland Fire and Rescue for 20 years. I currently also work in Portland's Bureau of Emergency Management. However, my testimony today is my own and may not represent the position of my employer. I'm speaking to you today in strong support of House Bill 2131. As Mayor Burns described on June 3rd of last year, a Union Pacific oil train derailed in Mosier and caught fire. There is no dispute that the responsibility for this disaster rests squarely with Union Pacific. As the Federal Railroad Administration reported, Union Pacific's failure to maintain its track equipment resulted in the derailment, end quote. Jim Hall, former chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, wrote an op-ed in the Oregonian just a week after the derailment, arguing that all oil-by-rail transport is inherently unsafe. And I quote, "We knew this would happen, and it did. It was only a matter of time before a train loaded with thousands of barrels of crude oil would derail and endanger one of our most natural wonders, the Columbia River Gorge. Although there was some leakage of oil into the river, the good news is that the fire was extinguished in less than 24 hours and no one was killed. Can we hope to be so lucky next time? In my 7 years as chairman of the NTSB, I saw firsthand the results of warnings unheeded. Carrying crude oil by rail is just not a good idea," end quote. Mr. Hall is correct. Mosier was lucky there was no wind that day. If there had been normal gorge winds, there would have been a regional wildland conflagration of cataclysmic proportions for miles in all directions, and Mosier would have been consumed by flames. Even more horrifying is that this derailment occurred just 250 yards from the Mosier Community School, and the school is full of kids. If the derailment had been closer or there had been normal gorge winds, the school would have been directly impacted by fire or completely incinerated. Let me put a finer point on that. Union Pacific's negligence almost killed as many as 220 school children. Now, I know Union Pacific is a big company, but does Union Pacific carry enough insurance to rebuild a destroyed city and compensate the families of hundreds of incinerated children? When 47 people were killed by an oil train in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, in July of 2013, MMA Railways went bankrupt only a month later, leaving the city out to dry. Oregonians deserve to know that won't happen here. Oregonians also deserve to know that UP will contribute enough to an Oregon oil spill contingency fund. They deserve to know that UP has a state-approved contingency plan, and they deserve to know that Union Pacific is providing adequate funding to our emergency responders for their training and equipment. Currently, I can assure you in this committee that this is not the case. Representative Johnson, when I was a Hood River City Councilor, I heard from our residents in our hometown loud and clear. Your constituents are counting on you and on this committee to protect us from these dangerous trains and the aftermath of the inevitable derailments that will occur. Please don't let us down and support 2131. Thank you.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Power, Vice Chair Johnson, and committee member, thank you for your time today. My name is Maria McCormick, and I work with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. I'm a family physician, and I've practiced medicine in Hood River for the last 15 years. My husband and I own a farm in Mosier, Oregon. My children attended Mosier School, and my younger son was an eighth grader when the June 3rd, 2016 train carrying Bakken crude oil derailed and caught fire 600 feet from the school playground with school in session. In retrospect, I realized that the Mosier oil train derailment was a predictable catastrophe. Mosier and Oregon were lucky that day. Unfortunately, as oil continues to travel by rail, we can count on the fact that there will be more accidents and perhaps far worse events similar to the 2013 Lac-Mégantic oil train derailment that killed 47 people, displaced 2,000 people from their homes, and destroyed much of the downtown core of that town. Besides the obvious potential for loss of life from an oil train accident, the health hazards of exposure to crude oil during spill and cleanup efforts include neurotoxicity, cancer, lung disease, loss of cognitive function, and endocrine disruption. The dispersant chemicals used in cleanup are also highly toxic and are associated with increased risk of cancer, lung, and endocrine diseases. Oil spills contaminating water reduce the viability of local healthy food choices and can lead to digestive and reproductive health risks. In Mosier's specific case, the oil spill contaminated the wastewater treatment plant, rendering town's sewage system inoperable, with residents unable to actually flush their toilets after the derailment until cleanup efforts kicked into gear. The cleanup after the 2016 derailment took months in Mosier. Now imagine an oil train derailment in Oregon in which lives are lost and catastrophic environmental and property damage occurs. How can we be sure that there's enough money set aside for the cost of a multi-million dollar cleanup effort? In my work as a primary care physician, I know that prevention is the best route to good health. In a similar vein, the railroads should be doing their best to prevent train accidents through regular maintenance and inspection of their lines. But I'm also very mindful of the fact that chronic disease, unpredictable health events, and accidents occur. In the case of healthcare, most of us are covered by medical insurance to assist with unexpected healthcare costs. Physicians themselves carry malpractice insurance. The state of Oregon requires those of us who drive things much smaller than oil trains to carry insurance. It should go without saying that railroads and the oil companies whose hazardous materials that railroads carry should have sufficient insurance to pay for the multi-million dollar massive cleanup when systems fail and an accident occurs. Please support HB 2131. I also strongly support HB 3344 with some additional language to support drinking water sources, specifically in Section 1B, add drinking water. For the reasons I've already stated, we value additional evaluation and scrutiny of new coal and oil terminals and hope you will pass strong safeguards for our lives and property. Thank you for your service to our great state and its citizens.
Thank you, Chair Helm and other board committee members for allowing me the opportunity to speak. My name is Eric Lichten-Taylor. I live in Corbett, and I've been in Corbett for the last 17 years. I live on the historic highway just a little west of the Women's Forum, surrounded by some of my Presbyterian friends, Manuka. Vice Chair Johnson, I appreciate your work on the congestion going on the historic highway. Thank you for that. I'm also not only speaking,
So I have been involved with Friends of the Gorge on their board for the last 6 years. I've been the chair for the last 3 years. But today I'm coming to speak as a resident of Corbett who lives in the Gorge. I'm a newbie, they call me in Corbett, because I've only been there 17 years. But my family does go back in Newburgh to around the 1840s, where we land claimed the east side of Newburgh. And so I grew up in Newburgh with a long history, stories, different train stories of my father traveling back and forth in the Gorge from Walla Walla, the Veterans Hospital there, to Portland while he was recovering from serious life-threatening injuries after being hit in France on the second day after he jumped in D-Day. And he loved to tell those stories, and he loved the Gorge. And so I would just like to share another small story. In 2016, in June of 2016, not only did Mosier dodge a bullet, but we dodged a bullet in Corbett as well. In 2003, when I was trying to landscape around my home in Corbett, I asked a friend who happened to be a landscape architect and a expert in forest fires, has written books in forest fires. I said, "Dean, you know, what can I do to like protect my home from a forest fire here? You know, what plants can I do? You know, what plants can I trim?" And he sort of laughed at me and he said, "If a forest fire ever starts on the south side of the Gorge, it's going to burn so hot and so fast, it is going to take everything in its path." And with a smile, he said, "But that's if the wind is blowing." So I pause there and say that from my experience, the wind is blowing often. So quite frankly, I am just here today to say that I am scared. People in our community are scared of the effects that when a crude oil train goes over again, what it might do to our community and what it might do to life in our area. And I just want to say that I support House Bill 3344 in requiring clear due diligence in the development of oil terminals. And I also support House Bill 2131 in relationship to funding safety and being proactive in regards to dealing with those crises. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thanks again for traveling today and being
here.
Thank
you.
Appreciate it. Is there anybody else that's here from over 100 miles that wanted to testify that I missed? Please come forward.
Am I the only one?
Yeah. We'll let you have your own panel. You'll introduce yourself for our record, please.
I will. I prefer to stand if you don't mind.
Sure.
Sheikh Pachwe, that means good day in our Walla Walla language. My Indian name is Wayausux. I'm also known by Kathy Sampson Cruzy. I'm a retired social worker and have enjoyed retirement immensely. I have a beloved husband that continues to work as a family practice physician for Indian Health Service. My home, I have two homes, one on our Umatilla Indian Reservation in Pendleton, Oregon. As our leader spoke earlier, we have three tribes. The Confederate Tribes of Umatilla has the Umatilla, the Cayuse, and my tribe, the Walla Walla. It's also, true name is Wululapum. My concern here today that brought me down that beautiful gorge was to let you know from a grandmother's perspective, a great-grandmother's perspective, the leadership that the state of Oregon has shown by presenting these two pieces of legislation before you. The testimony that you have heard has been heartfelt, and I feel very strongly that they should both be supported and move quickly through the process. some of our esteemed colleagues from the railroad are here, and I just want to let them know a little bit of our history, because in 1855, our treaty would not have been ratified if we had not made our mark on that piece of paper that said, yes, you can come through our homelands. They come over the pass. One of the most treacherous passes, as you know, is called Meacham, and come down through our reservation, right by our health clinic, right near our Head Start, right near our Nichiawe Community School, right through our senior center, and on through into Pendleton, and down through Umatilla and across to the Boardman area, to the gorge, and disperses. On both sides, as we fish the river, the great river, the big one, Nichewanapum, there is a convergence, not only in the gorge, but up further through Pasco, the Wallula Gap, and down through the great river, of multiple oil trains, coal trains, on both sides. And I don't fish there any longer, but from my dear friends and family that do, it has become pretty hazardous. One of the things I'm afraid that's happened lately is many of our tribal leaders, there are four treaty tribes on the Columbia that you will know, two treaty tribes from our tribe, the Confederate Tribes of Umatilla, and then the Wasco Warm Springs Paiute tribes in central Oregon. Across the river, there's the Great Yakima tribe. And up in Idaho, there's the Nimiipuu, the Nez Perce tribe. Those four treaty tribes combine a very rich and long history within these three now states. One of the things that I think some of our railroad people or government people don't quite understand is that true connection between those treaty tribes. It's very strong. We're intermarried. We have children throughout this entire region that we raise. One of the things that I saw coming down the gorge was there's a little tiny flower. It's called a prairie star. And that prairie star is starting to bloom. And one of the things that this homeland gives us is a rich tradition of carrying on culture. It's carrying on namings. It's carrying on the first rituals of having a salmon in your family, of a young fisherman or fisherwoman. It's carrying on the... Why we go up there and start looking for those kind of flowers is we know that the hahn, the tops of the bitterroot, the biscuit root, the celery, the onion, I could go on, are starting to come up. And all of that rich diversity in that culture, our young ones are brought out there to start to pray in ceremony and to dig and have what's called a first foods feast. It's very important that we remember many of us don't just go to Safeway. We go out into those sacred areas and gather those foods and those medicines, not only from the river, not only that old sturgeon and those eels and that king salmon, but from all around those regions. So part of what I'm not hearing today is about that sacred space that is all through our beautiful Northwest states that I love so much. I went to Alaska when I was young after I'd got my graduate degree and went up in a hospital and worked for a while. And the Yupik, Chupik, and Athabascan people, they are really true subsistence people still. And I would share some of our cultures about how we do namings and ceremony, and they would share theirs. But one of the things, the threads that ran through all of our conversations was things are changing. We know they're going to change. How are we going to get our voice heard when we don't have state representatives that listen? We don't have senators that really come to talk to us. We were all shocked when Barack Obama came to Pendleton on his first presidential run. But it was like, our leaders are so busy with this full plate just trying to protect sovereign rights that are always under attack that sometimes it's hard to branch out into state issues. We have legislative aides and we have a lot of good attorneys that we've been able to hire now since we're a little more prosperous. But what truly comes down to the core of who we are as people, as human beings together in this beautiful planet, is that we have to protect the sacred. And I think the responsibility that you have before you in passing this kind of legislation that not only protects those that will be first responders, but also those that will look at future facilities, energy site facilities that may not be in our best interest. I am oil and coal terminal fighter. I don't want them here. I want clean, sustainable energy as fast as possible. And by 2025, I'm going to have a Tukosh cane and I may still be coming to hearings and see some of you. But it's like we all have to be in this together. Some of the treaty tribes that stand together now used to dispute things along the river. We used to have our internal conflicts. I think that some of the dangers that are now before us has put us even closer together. And we have allies that are trusted through the Friends of the Gorge or the Columbia River Keeper. I mean, you could go on and on and on and name some of the good people that have said, hey, tribes, we're here to help you as well. And I think that's been a powerful alliance. And I would like to see that continue with some of the good work that you're doing here in Salem. And I really am honored to be in front of you. I'm humbled to be here to speak. As I said in the press conference, I'm not an elected official. Many people all turn around and my name is Ulla. That's grandma. I'm always hearing someone call out for me, or Kuthla on the women's side. But I have got to know a very good friend who is also a past Oregonian, and her name is Winona LaDuke. And she is just a dear sister friend, as my sister friend from Mosier is. Where did she go? Did she go? Winona talks about a prophecy for her Anishinaabe people. And when I was at Standing Rock with her for a little while, we sat and talked about some of the huge confluences that are coming, the powers that are coming towards our environment and our way of life. She talks about this is a time when our people will have two roads ahead of us. One path is very well worn, but it is scorched. Another path, which is green. It will be our choice upon which path to embark. So no, we know that the federal legislation from a long, long time ago, 1855, is amongst us, and we cannot stop it at this point. But we do know that in the hearts of our children's children, we know that you're going to be making the right choices for us. So we thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We really appreciate it. Next, I'm going to invite Aaron Hunt and John Hellman up. Welcome.
Thank you.
At least one of you is from 100 miles or more away.
Johan is.
I am.
I'm based in Portland.
Johan, I'm sorry. I've got...
That's fine.
Did not read your name right.
I didn't know how to pronounce it the first time I met him either.
It happens every day.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Hunt. I'm Director of Public Affairs for Union Pacific, based here in Oregon, and appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. With 1,100 miles of track in the state, our company employs over 1,600 Oregonians, and we're a key part of the state's infrastructure. We've invested over $1 billion in the last 10 years, enhancing our rail infrastructure, modernizing rail yards, and other rail-related work. The Mosier derailment was a terrible incident. It's the kind of incident that all of us at Union Pacific work every day to prevent. And since the derailment, we have owned the response. We worked directly with emergency responders in the community to mitigate the fire and spill in the immediate aftermath of the incident. We have worked directly with the Department of Environmental Quality to fully remediate the wastewater treatment plant and mitigate any groundwater issues in the Mosier area resulting from the derailment. And we continue to have a dialogue with Team Mosier, which is the group of three agencies, including the City of Mosier, the school district, and the fire district, that signed an intergovernmental agreement. And we're having a dialogue with them to discuss and resolve derailment issues over the long term. One of the many reasons the federal government requires railroads to transport hazmat is the strong safety record that railroads have moving those types of commodities. We recognize, however, that incidents do happen, and we must continue improving safety. As you know, we worked closely with the Oregon State Legislature in 2015 to pass HB 3225. When we collaborated with you to pass that bill, Oregon's collective response capabilities for rail accidents were enhanced. HB 3225 required the Oregon State Fire Marshal to adopt a plan for coordinated response, as was discussed, to oil or hazardous material spills or releases that occur during rail transport. HB 3225 also required annual reports be submitted to Legislative Assembly. The reports include inventory of all emergency response resources available in the state, suggested changes to structure for continued coordination between state agencies and industry, possible revisions to response roles or responsibilities of state agencies, local governments, and railroads, and strategies for ensuring adequate funding at state and local government levels to cover training, equipment, and administrative costs associated with providing comprehensive response and equipment. Equipment and training was also provided by Oregon's railroads through HB 3225. Eight regional support flatbed trailers, six from Union Pacific and two from BNSF Railway, were delivered to the state along with 40 scholarships for Oregon first responders to attend crude oil by rail training at the Rail Industries Transportation Technology Center in Pueblo, Colorado. Additionally, the railroads committed to conducting four tabletop drills annually at sites selected by OSFM. This was all in addition to Union Pacific's ongoing work to train Oregon's emergency responders. Union Pacific has trained more than 2,300 Oregon emergency responders since 2010. We have shown that we want to partner with the state to enhance rail safety, and we continue these efforts this session as we work with Oregon stakeholders, including OSFM, ODOT Rail, Department of Environmental Quality, and with other railroads to develop a second rail safety legislation phase. It's our goal to find a solution that meets the state's needs, but we cannot support HB 2131 as written. HB 2131 is invalid under the Federal Railroad Safety Act, which preempts state safety laws where the federal government has regulations covering the subject matter. The bill is invalid under the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act of 1995, which broadly preempts state economic regulation of federal rail operators or any preclearance requirements. HB 2131 also violates the Federal Railroad Revitalization and Regulatory Reform Act, also known as the 4R Act, which bars states from imposing any tax that discriminates against a rail carrier. So again, we are committed to building upon 2015's HB 3225, and we look forward to continuing our work with all stakeholders in the coming weeks. I'm happy to take questions after Johan
gives his testimony.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and thank you as well for staying late for a thorough consideration of this issue. I really appreciate the additional time that you're giving to this issue. For the record, my name is Johan Hellman, and I'm the Regional Assistant Vice President of Government Affairs for the Northern Tier of the BNSF Railway Company. I'm based out of Seattle, Washington, so while I did travel more than 100 miles, I'm still a native Northwesterner. Thinking of myself that way, grew up here fishing and hiking, climbing in the mountains. I'm testifying today opposed to House Bill 2131 as it appears before you this afternoon. Just to begin, I can say unambiguously that at BNSF, safety is the core mission of our railroad, and it's at the heart of everything that we do. And in supporting this mission, just by example, last year alone, we trained more than 800 first responders throughout the Pacific Northwest in specialized response tactics for addressing crude oil and hazmat train incidents and events. We trained more than 3,500 first responders in this region over the last 5 years, and more than 70,000 across our network since 1996. This is part of our commitment and a longstanding commitment that we make to the communities that we travel through. We also station response and recovery equipment throughout the region. As you heard, we deployed without hesitation when we heard that there was a derailment in Mosier, and that's standard operating procedure, I believe, within our industry and certainly between our companies. We've also advocated for safer tank car standards at the federal level. We've also worked with states including California, Washington, and Oregon to help meet our common interest in increasing and improving safe transport of all materials and cargoes via rail. And this commitment from BNSF and other railroads is a key reason why rail remains the safest and most efficient method of moving cargo over land, and part of the reason why it's required by the federal government as part of the mandate that we have to carry all legal cargoes as part of our common carrier agreement with the federal government. Speaking to the underlying bill, I would offer a few observations. First, in general, and as you've heard throughout this afternoon, the federal government maintains broad preemptive authority over railroad regulations, which presents special challenges in crafting state legislation and creating regulations that are enforceable. We have concerns with the definition of terminal as used in this bill, consistency of this term throughout the statute, as it may be contradictory, which could make the contingency plans conceived within this legislation difficult to achieve. The language referring to navigable waters is problematic because it lends itself to ambiguities and potential unintended consequences. The term itself has a clear legal definition, which, for example, may not include inland watersheds and may conflict with waters of the state or waters of the U.S., so it creates a lot of potential unintended consequences in implementation. The definition of worst-case spill is also problematic. One of the regulatory challenges that's emerging in many states is that there are conflicting definitions of reasonable worst-case oil spill. In some states, there's even conflicting definitions between state agencies. The state of Washington is an example of that. So this general lack of agreement between states, between state agencies, potentially between different statutes, lends itself to the need for more consistent definitions, at least between states, and probably would lend itself to intrusion by the federal government as well. Finally, we're concerned about the feasibility of the prescribed response times outlined in the bill, as they may not necessarily be feasible or even safe in a real-life response event, and also with some of the broad references to personnel, as we see these as somewhat vague. Regarding the proposed substitute bill, which circulated late on Friday and we've only taken a precursory look at, we support a continuing discussion about training and equipment. And I think that's something that we've been supportive of for several years. We continue to look forward to additional conversations about how we can be helpful in that regard. However, we have concerns about sections of the proposed amendment which may conflict with federal statutes regarding economic regulation, preclearance requirements, as you heard earlier from my colleague, as well as train routes and routing. So for these reasons, we oppose the bill as it currently appears before this committee. However, we hope to continue this discussion and certainly want to serve as a resource as this discussion continues, especially if it builds on the success of 3225, given the limits of federal preemption and limited state resources, but those themes of communication, coordination, training, practice that we heard earlier from first responders, we certainly support those and want to serve as a resource in helping you pursue those. If I could mention just very quickly, regarding House Bill 3344, we would respectfully submit that the bill as it's currently written raises a number of questions about ambiguities, potential unintended consequences, for example, regarding the language that would prohibit the legislature from funding new bulk coal or oil terminal projects. As I read the bill, it's unclear how broadly this can be construed, and it raises the question of regulatory consideration or permitting alone would be enough to trigger the prohibition. The financial reporting requirements may conflict with federal statutes prohibiting the economic regulation of railroads, and the balancing test is also broadly written, difficult to enforce, likely broad unintended consequences. So for these reasons, we oppose the bill as written. However, as I said earlier, we would be pleased to serve as a resource as you develop these concepts and certainly look forward to working with you as you develop language within these bills. I'd like to thank you for your time this afternoon. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from committee members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Thank both of you guys for being here. Aaron, you made the statement early when you first started regarding Mosier that we've owned the response. And yeah, I think I know what you're talking about in that you've remained on site. You've done as much as you can, continue to work with Team Mosier and all the folks there to try to, you know, get the situation correct. But I think there's just a general within my constituents, there's just a general longing for some sort of assurance that whether it's UP, whether it's BNSF or whomever, that you do in fact can guarantee the community you have the resources necessary to, you know, to battle any contingency that may arise. You know, and when I was out there, you know, the day after the incident in Mosier, I think I even asked, I forget who it was you guys had on the ground at that time, but do you carry an insurance plan? What kind of premiums do you pay and that kind of stuff? And I think the answer I got was basically, well, it's the full faith and credit of UP that backs this up. So you want to check with the market capitalization. That's how much is available on the line. So could you just address that a bit? I mean,
sure.
I think you're self-insured, correct?
We are. Union Pacific Railroad is self-insured. And, you know, when you look at Mosier, you look at the remediation that's been underway since June 3rd, 2016. The first thing that we did was make sure that any claims that community members had that where they needed support, they needed as we managed the fire over the first couple of days, that they were taken care of. And as a matter of fact, we're trying to wrap up the last couple of those now. We've been in regular touch with community members since that time. You know, we have a dedicated risk management team that does that work. We work with specialized contractors that are subject matter experts as it relates to remediation, environmental remediation. In this case, CH2M Hill is our environmental contractor, and we have weekly calls with the city and CH2M Hill and Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. As we continue to measure, we have a number of sparging wells that have been dropped to continue to measure and watch over the groundwater situation. And then we're continuing to work with Team Mosier. We've had multiple meetings with Team Mosier. We're meeting with them again this week. And in all of this, we have invested dramatic amounts of money. You know, we've invested $1 billion in Oregon, as I said, in our infrastructure, and that's all part of our ongoing effort to operate more safely and more efficiently. So we're going to continue to be a part of the Mosier community. We operate through hundreds of communities here in the Pacific Northwest, and we're going to be a part of those communities. The railroad is a part of the history of the gorge. And we plan to be a part of the future, and part of that will be our ongoing effort to continue to operate better and safer as we move forward. But yes, we are self-insured, and that's how we handle these types of incidents when they do take place.
Follow up? Yeah, just a quick follow. I appreciate that, and just to add to that point, if you all in your PR department might think about a way to effectively communicate that. I understand what you're saying, but I mean, it should be a good point to be able to get out there to people to reassure them that you have the resources available to put into any sort of incident that would occur to make it right to the extent that it could be. The second point I would just add, and I think both of you talked about this, in terms of the dollars and the investments you made in first responder training and so forth, that's been great. The hazmat trailers have been a great addition as well, but we still need to get one of those located in the Central Gorge because we just got to have one there. And I would just add, too, from the experience of Mosier, we found, you know, it's not foam that puts out these sorts of fires. It's a lot of water. And I think every hazmat trailer in that region should have some sort of water pumping device on it that could be deployed anywhere in the event that we couldn't get tanker trucks. We couldn't get, you know, Mosier happened in a really convenient spot. I mean, it was a bad, obviously bad, terrible thing, but it happened in a convenient spot. You could easily get assets to it to put out the fire. If something else would happen in another more remote area, you know, you might have access to water, but you don't have a way to get it to the fire. I think that would be really beneficial to make sure every hazmat trailer has that sort of remote capability, too.
Understood.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm going to invite Michael Lang, Dan Serres, Dr. Pat O'Haron, and Dr. Theodora Tsongas.
Mr. Chair, I have some written testimony to submit into the record. And I also would like to, if it's not already in the record, submit the Federal Railroad Administration report on the accident at Mosier into the record.
Yeah, you may. It's not in the record yet.
And also including statistics by the FRA and Union Pacific rail safety as compared to the industry average. Thank you. May I?
Please go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 2131 and House Bill 3344. For the record, my name is Michael Lang. I'm Conservation Director for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. We, Friends of the Columbia Gorge, are also members of the Stand Up to Oil Coalition. And the Stand Up to Oil Coalition opposes new oil terminals in the Northwest and also is opposed to the transportation of crude oil by rail along the Columbia River and also through the states of Oregon and Washington. And at this moment, I want to thank the committee for having a hearing on these bills and for your attention to this matter. I also want to thank the sponsors of the bills, too, for bringing these forward. Friends in the Stand Up to Oil Coalition support House Bill 2131 and House Bill 3344. These bills are crafted to respond to a new and growing threat of transportation of large volumes of oil by rail through Oregon. For decades, Oregon has taken pride in the fact that we have strong values, a vision for the future of our state, and planning to ensure that our common vision becomes a reality. Livable communities, clean air and water, sustainable economic growth, and the protection of our natural treasures like the Columbia River Gorge are all values that we cherish. However, in the past 5 years, external forces, including advances in fracking technology to extract oil that was previously unreachable, exponential increases in the transportation of crude oil by rail, and the lifting of the crude oil export ban have caught Oregon unprepared. House Bill 2131 and House Bill 3344 are necessary to help us respond to a changing world and to ensure the protection of the values that Oregonians hold dear. I'm going to, a lot has been said about 2131, so I'm going to focus the remainder of my comments on 3344. That's the oil terminal bill. This bill would close a big loophole in state law called the wharfing exemption. The wharfing exemption allows the construction of oil terminals on state submerged lands without requiring a state land lease. House Bill 3344 would require the following: insurance to cover worst-case oil spills, state land leases for the construction of new oil terminals, an analysis of public need and the risk to public health, safety, and the environment for oil terminal projects, and a balancing test for removal and fill permits for oil terminal projects. We've heard a lot of testimony about oil by rail and its increase. I think we can summarize by saying oil by rail is inherently unsafe. In the past 3 years, again, summarizing, several oil train derailments, explosions, and fires in North America have resulted in 47 deaths, the evacuations of thousands of people, millions of gallons of oil spilled into waterways, and billions of dollars in property damage. The damages from the Loch Mogontique derailment exceeded $2 billion, and they're still counting. There are several oil-by-rail terminals proposed in the Northwest that are still active. The largest is the Tesoro Vancouver Energy Project. This would be the largest oil-by-rail terminal in North America. 15 million gallons of oil per day would be transported through the Columbia River Gorge by rail to serve that terminal if it's approved. And then compounding all of these threats is the lifting of the crude oil export ban. For 35 years, the United States ensured its energy independence by prohibiting the transport or export of crude oil. In 2015, Congress lifted the crude oil export ban, and our concern is that once the price of oil rebounds, we'll see a spate of oil terminal proposals for export purposes hitting the Northwest, in particular coming to Oregon. We can expect to see these proposals, and without House Bill 3344, oil terminals will easily spread into Oregon. Oregon has the weakest laws in the West Coast related to oil trains and terminals. Both California and Washington have passed laws similar to House Bill 2131 and House Bill 3344. Our friends at the railroad do like to talk about federal preemption, and it is a reality. However, these laws have not been preempted by federal railroad laws. They have withstood challenges so far. And also your legislative council have vetted these, of course, for constitutionality and have arrived at that conclusion. So in addition, California and Washington have comprehensive environmental policy acts. As you know, Oregon does not. So Oregon not only has a wharfing exemption, it also does not have the ability to comprehensively look at the public health, safety, and environmental impacts of oil by rail proposals. House Bill 3344 addresses these gaping loopholes. The combination of a really weak oil train safety law, the lack of environmental policy act, and exemptions for terminals make Oregon a soft target for oil by rail transport and terminals. So in conclusion, friends in the Stand Up to Oil Committee, our coalition, don't want Oregon to be the weak spot, the soft spot for coming oil terminals. We encourage you to support House Bill 2131 and House Bill 3344. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, Representative Goholby. My name is Dan Sears. I'm the Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper. We're also a member of the Stand Up to Oil Coalition, and so I'm not going to repeat most of what Michael said, which was, I think, a pretty comprehensive look at why we support House Bill 2131 and 3344. I think I want to just lay out the perspective from sort of a river advocate for the stakes involved with oil by rail. We spent hundreds of millions of dollars improving and restoring habitat for salmon in the lower Columbia River, and all of that is at risk with oil by rail shipments. It's one of the reasons why House Bill 3344 is incredibly important to Riverkeeper, to our members, and to the Stand Up Oil to Oil Coalition. It confers the right, basically, to the Department of State Lands to do this balancing test, which weighs the impacts of an oil spill against the benefits. Our neighbors to the north and south already do this. The Tesoro Savage project in Vancouver is going through a multi-year review process where they're asking just the same question. They're asking whether the benefits of the project outweigh the impacts. And in doing that, they actually did a study looking at the impacts of an oil spill on the lower Columbia River, not assessing the human health and the safety impacts, but just the impact of the spill on the fishery, on the habitat. They found that a spill could cause anywhere from a couple hundred million to over $1 billion in damage. I'll submit the study into the record for your review. That was an eye-opener, showing that a spill in the Columbia River could impact, you know, everyone's district all the way down to Representative Boone and Astoria, who can't be here, but it's remarkable to think about the scale of the threat that we're dealing with. The city of Vancouver is the site of the largest proposed oil-by-rail terminal in North America. Some of those trains could very well come on the Oregon side of the river. So Oregon, as a pass-through state, can look at some of these risk analyses from other places. The city of Vancouver hired a risk expert, and they didn't look at the oil spill. They looked at what would happen if a train derailed in Vancouver. And they concluded, based on the expert review of a group called the Blackburn Group, that it could cause up to $5 billion in damage to the city of Vancouver. Those same types of oil trains would go through Portland. And so over Portland's aquifer, its backup drinking water source. And this is, again, we're looking at very significant impacts. And so there are folks here today from Mosier, from Eugene, from all over the state to ask you to support House Bill 3344 and 2131. I would just close by saying preemption is clearly going to be an issue for the railroads. Your legislative council took a hard look at this and found that this wasn't preempted, that preemption wasn't triggered by what's contemplated in these bills. Other states are doing similar legislation. And I would also say that in the wake of what happened in Mosier, with so much at risk, so much clearly at risk, Oregonians are looking to our legislature to lead in protecting these very vital, very vulnerable resources. These two pieces of legislation accomplish that. Thank you.
I have to be 12 inches away. Good afternoon, Chair Helm and Representative Hulvey. I'm an environmental health, I'm Dr. Theodora Tsongas. I'm an environmental health scientist with 40 years experience evaluating the health and safety impacts of environmental contamination. Formerly, I was an environmental epidemiologist with the Oregon Health Division, where I coordinated the Hazardous Substances Emergency Event Surveillance System, tracking spills and releases of hazardous materials in Oregon. I have held appointments as Adjunct Associate Professor of Community Health at Portland State University and of Environmental Health at the University of Colorado at Denver. I'm a member of the Environmental Health Working Group of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and a community member of the Multnomah County Local Emergency Planning Committee. I'm here today to support House Bill 2131 and House Bill 3344. I live in Multnomah County, and I'm familiar with the risks associated with oil unit trains coming through the state. I have spent the past 3 years tracking the health hazards associated with dangerous trains and coal, propane, LNG, and oil export terminals. These risks exist throughout the state along the rail lines, not just in Multnomah County, where 20% of the population lives and works within the blast zone of oil trains. Multnomah County is only one of the many counties that could be affected. What we value of life and property are at risk now along the rail lines. These bills are designed to protect human life and property. The health and safety risks are many. Fires, explosions, derailments, and oil and hazardous material spills. The potential to contaminate precious drinking water supplies, destruction of valuable habitat and agricultural land, increased wear and tear on rail beds from longer, heavier trains traveling at increasing speeds. Diesel emissions and fine particulates, heavy metals, as well as other toxic constituents of the hazardous materials are released into the environment through normal railroad and terminal operation, as well as accidental leaks, spills, and releases. We know the risks from experience in Mosier where the public health impacts included evacuation, school closure, hazardous air quality, loss of drinking water system, loss of sewer system, contamination of groundwater, and the Columbia River. We need to consider the long-term as well as the short-term impacts of incidents like this one. Mental trauma to children and residents, impacts of inhalation exposure to the smoke and particulates released by the explosion and fire, damage to feelings of a safe and secure home, economic near ruin of the city, loss of property values and income from tourism. And these continue with the drain on economic resources to repair the damage and the permanent loss of resources such as forests and crops. Railroads operating at high hazard trail routes must be responsible for the risks incurred by their activities. That is why I fully support these two very important, with minor amendments, bills to help protect the health and well-being of the people of Oregon. Thanks for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair Helm, Representative Holvey. I really appreciate you doing the work on these bills as well as taking time to hear my testimony. And I appreciate
Let's get your name on the record.
Oh, yeah.
First.
Dr. Thanks. Patrick O'Haron. I'm the president of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility as well as a practicing general surgeon. I appreciate you staying late to hear our testimony, and I'll try not to repeat any of the things that have already been mentioned. But I would like to point out a few things that as I've been listening to testimony, seem like obvious points that haven't necessarily been brought up specifically. As a surgeon, I don't particularly have a lot of experience or expertise in transporting hazardous materials, but I do have some experience in performing a job that involves risk is just part of the inherent performance of a job, much like transporting oil by rail. I think one thing to recognize is that Oregonians are both taking on the cost as well as the risk involved in transporting oil through rail. We've heard about we're a pass-through city, which means we get none of the economic benefits. But when an accident happens, it happens to Oregonians. Likewise with the spill, a second point is that no business is too large to fail. So when I hear that Union Pacific is their own insurer, that gives me a lot of pause. Another point is that I heard some mention about federal regulations. The one that really sticks out in my mind is that it won't be till 2025 until all these rail cars are expected to be DOT 117s. Anyone paying attention to federal politics certainly can see that expecting the federal government to improve regulations that protect health and safety is not likely to happen in the next few years. And if anything, we've seen reporting that say that industries have been able to more or less approach the current administration and ask for what regulations they'd like rescinded. So I think expecting that the federal government is going to step up and protect Oregonians around oil by rail transport is semi-delusional. And to tie into that, we heard assurances around how much the resources of Union Pacific, for instance, and I know the resources of the oil refineries and the drilling companies are substantial as well. If I would be much more reassured if they stepped up and replaced all the DOT 111s with 117s and bought some insurance rather than understand their economic might. So I strongly urge you to adopt these two bills. I think that is, I'd like to perhaps the best quote I've heard today from the fire chief is that oil by rail is nuts, I think he put it, and it really is. There's a real optics problem that people claim this is a safe endeavor, and the optic is a exploding fireball. And we're talking about a lot of fireballs, not just Lac Mégantic, and granted, trains pass through areas that are generally, or a lot of area that's not populated, but and so there hasn't been a huge loss of life outside of Lac Mégantic, but at least 10 massive explosions and fires, many of which burn for 2 or 3 days because Representative Johnson pointed out that water helps, but mostly it's just time until all the oil that's spilled is burned up. So we should do everything we can to protect Oregonians in lieu of the fact that the state's hands are tied to some degree by federal regulations. So I appreciate the work you're doing and support strongly these two bills.
Very good. Thank you all for your testimony. And I'm going to invite Betsy Hitz and Linda Kelly up. And after that, on deck are Michael O'Leary, Bob Rees, and Rob Bissonnel.
Good late afternoon, representatives. My name is Betsy Hitz. I'm here from Eugene, Oregon. I'm here today to testify in support of HB 2131 and HB 3344. On January 25th, 2017, the Eugene City Council passed Resolution 5181. I am a member of 350 Eugene, the originator of this resolution. This document has been provided to Representative Holvey's office and electronically into the record. The resolution reads as follows. A resolution opposing transportation of oil by rail through the City of Eugene. The City Council of the City of Eugene finds that A, there has been a significant increase in the transportation of crude oil by rail through the Pacific Northwest to existing terminals and refineries on the West Coast. Oil is transported by rail through Portland to an existing terminal in Columbia County and to refineries in California. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, oil transportation by rail has increased 50 to 60 times above the levels that existed prior to 2010. 15 oil by rail terminals are proposed, under construction, or currently operating in Oregon and Washington. B. Much of the oil being transported by rail is highly volatile oil from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota. The oil is often being transported in tank cars called DOT 111s, which were never intended to transport volatile crude oil. The U.S. DOT identifies the blast zone resulting from an oil train accident, fire, and explosion involving Bakken oil as being 0.5 to 1 mile in all directions. Serious risks are caused by oil by rail projects, including but not limited to delayed emergency vehicles, oil fires, oil spills, oil explosions resulting from train derailments, increased air pollution, increased water pollution, and contributions to climate disruption, induced injury and disease. C. Since 2013, oil train accidents have caused 47 deaths, the evacuation of thousands of residents, and billions of dollars in property damage and environmental destruction. In June 2016, four train cars carrying crude oil derailed going through the Columbia River Gorge in the town of Mosier, Oregon. The train cars caught fire, prompting evacuation of residents, schools, and businesses, and damage to the local water supply, sewer system, and soil. In September 2016, 13 train cars derailed in Eugene, including one containing highly flammable liquefied petroleum gas. D. New rules adopted by the U.S. Department of Transportation fail to ensure the safety of communities or the environment from catastrophic accidents, spill, explosions, and fires. E. In the event of an accident, explosion, and fire involving an oil train, local emergency responders would be ill-equipped to protect human health, property, or the environment. Emergency responders would likely focus on evacuation while allowing the oil fire to burn itself out. And finally, F. The City Council seeks to address the immediate issue of new oil by rail proposals in a timely manner, as well as those oil trains already moving through Eugene. And my cohort continues.
I'm Linda Kelly, and I'm also with 350 Eugene, and we worked on getting this resolution passed. So to continue the resolution, therefore, be it resolved by the City Council of the City of Eugene and a municipal corporation of the State of Oregon as follows. One, City Council opposes oil by rail transportation through and within the City of Eugene. Two, the City Council supports the preparation of a programmatic, comprehensive, and area-wide environmental impact statement to identify the cumulative effects that would result from existing and proposed oil by rail terminals, as well as the development and review of a comprehensive health impact assessment prior to approval of any new oil transfer and storage permits by any state, regional, or federal agency. Excuse me. Three, the City Council directs the City Manager to send letters to Senator Wyden and Merkley and Congressman DeFazio requesting they develop legislation that requires railroad companies and or oil companies to make public any development plans for increased rail traffic that accommodate oil transport and storage, to provide adequate notice to local communities of any plans for new or expanded rail facilities or any anticipated increases in rail traffic volume, and they submit an emergency environmental cleanup plan in case of accidental spills or train derailment. The city manager is also directed to send the letter and resolution to Governor Kate Brown and the local state legislative delegation. 4, the City Council supports economic growth that contributes to citizens' health and safety and well-being, and that on balance adheres to principles of sustainable development and overall reduction of carbon emissions. 5, the resolution is effective immediately upon its passage by the City Council. The foregoing resolution adopted 25th of January 2017, Beth Forrest, City Recorder. Excuse me. So Eugene is on an oil train route, along with many other Oregon cities. Our resolution closely follows Portland resolution, which is number 37164. So we ask you to support and pass HB 33 and HB 2131. We feel they're important bills to address oil trains, requiring railroads to plan for hazards and address potential financial liabilities, and allowing the DSL, Department of State Lands, to evaluate the risks of oil terminals themselves. These measures really help pass through communities like Eugene that otherwise lack any meaningful ability to address the oil train risks. So that's really the end of my prepared and written statement. I just want to say one or two other sentences. We know that transport of fossil fuels is inherently very dangerous by its nature. And I want to reflect some of what was said earlier, which is, you know, at this point in time, no matter what you feel about the 99.5% of scientists who say we're in trouble with the environment and with climate change, I think we need to really recognize that we do have two paths. And for all of our sakes, for every living creature on this earth, we need to be wise in the path that we choose and choose a safe path. And that path is there in front of us. You know, we are selling wind energy to California that has requirements for sustainable energy. And I think we just need to do everything we can to both put a placeholder here with these things to keep us as safe as possible and to really put the brakes on any new oil and fossil fuel developments in the state while we are working to really develop a safe future for all of us. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for staying and hearing our testimony.
Thank you for traveling.
Thank you.
All right. Michael Leary, Bob Rees, and Rob. Rob, you got it. I got it. Bignall?
Bignall.
Yeah. Let's see, Scott.
Good evening.
Good evening.
We'll get started. I know you're here extra time. We appreciate that very much.
Thanks for staying.
For the record, my name is Bob Rees. I'm executive director for the Association of Northwest Steelheaders with 1,600 members, 11 chapters in the Pacific Northwest. We are in favor of House Bill 3344 and House Bill 2131. Thank you for bringing this important legislation forward. Sport fishing in the region is a $2.4 billion a year industry, supporting over 34,000 jobs between Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Until we curb our thirst for oil, we need to do everything in our power to make sure it's safe to transport and consume. As Mosier has shown us, those safety measures don't exist along some of the most important waterways to our community. The testimony that is going to be circulated shows the economic impact of sport fishing in the region. $2.4 billion in retail sales, state and local tax revenues, $246 million, total fishing days, $24 million, 2 million anglers in Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. Salaries over $1.2 billion. Our sport opportunity is growing, but any momentum can be instantly wiped out with a single disaster such as the oil derailment on the Columbia or in the pristine Deschutes River. You've often heard that the decline of wild salmon is a result of 1,000 cuts. An oil spill dramatically increases the deep cuts we've already inflicted on these iconic species. 13 of them are listed in the Columbia Basin wild salmon and steelhead stocks. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers stated that consequences of an oil spill may very well constitute a take under the ESA. This only exacerbates the level of consequence that exists when the next spill occurs. Army Corps of Engineers also had stated that a small amount of oil can disrupt fish passage in the fish ladders that exist on the impoundments on the Columbia, something we're already having enough trouble with. I think I'll just close by saying we are just starting to realize the social and economic benefits of the sport fishing community, of the outdoor recreational industry. Let's put in place the protection measures needed that allows our community to grow and to thrive. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, Representative Holvey. My name is Rob Bignall. I represent the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association. I'm a working fishing guide that works the mainstream of the Columbia River and the Pacific Ocean. Over the last 40 years, my experiences include 15 years of oilfield construction diving off of Kenai, Alaska, on the oil platforms, working construction on the Alyeska pipeline, and managing a portion of the Exxon Valdez cleanup. I was intricately involved with the Exxon Valdez spill, including sending two of the first barges to Seattle within the first 48 hours of the Valdez incident, and then on to constructing and managing a floating man camp on the Resurrection Bay Railroad barge that housed 524, but we fed 750 personnel. Early on, the state of Alaska negotiated with Alyeska Pipeline in 1973, where Exxon, a third-party carrier in Alyeska, would use great care in having a contingency plan to avoid a catastrophic spill. Well, it took 3 days to get any support to the Exxon Valdez, which is approximately 50 miles away, and this is after 12 years of shipping oil. Committee members, we have had a wake-up call with Mosier incident, and lucky for us, it was one of the only land areas along the railroad right-of-way next to the Columbia River and not a water spill. The Columbia River watershed is fresh water, not salt water. The major cleanup in Alaska was not hot water, high pressure cleaning, not mechanical cleanup, not a bioremediation, but Mother Nature herself. And this is the nature of salt water, but not fresh water. And now those efforts may take years. My questions to you are, where are the station materials of boat containment vessels strategically stored in response in a free-flowing river? Who works with the Army Corps of Engineers to shut down the dams for water flow? What trained labor force response teams are to be used? Because working with the railroad, they'll use their own. And what about economic impacts of the fishery loss and transportation creating thousands of lawsuits? And that's what happened in Valdez. When does the risk control economic growth? Exxon Valdez lost approximately 11 million gallons of bulk fuel oil. The damage is spread over 11,000 square miles of the Prince William Sound, or 1,000 gallons per square mile. A railroad tanker car carries about 30,000 gallons, so one car loss of fuel would contaminate the total pool between Bonneville and the Dalles Dam, and that'd be equaling the Exxon spill. And who ever heard of a one-car rail incident? Exxon's lack of preparedness for an incident was the greatest cause of untold damage to the economy and to the ecosystem, and the real results were lawsuits and years of litigation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay.
Let's see here. How do I get rid of that and get something else? Sorry, I'm a Mac person. This is all very complicated to me. I just talk at it and it works. Let's see. So I'm looking for the... This one here, right? No, try office. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry about that. Was that before? I'm not sure. It was probably the railroad guys. No, I'm just kidding. Thank you. For the record, my name is Michael O'Leary. I live in Portland. I work for and I'm a member of the Northwest Steelheaders. This is the best use of the Columbia River I can think of. This is out by Astoria. I took this photo literally from the bridge. It was kind of harrowing with the traffic. That's the legacy we've been inherited. That's the legacy we have to give. Going from ocean to table. Nature and the economy, a trade. That's the past, and I hope that that's the future. If I knew how to advance this, I guess I would. Just use the arrow. Oh, nice. No?
Keyboard, sorry about
that. Oh, great. And so on June 3rd, at 12:14.
Mosier, overpass.
We're in Mosier?
Yes, overpass.
Okay.
He says that trains derail and there's a fire.
Train derailed and there is a fire.
A novel call for the 911 worker, clearly, and for us as well. I drove up. I got the news about 12:30. The phone started lighting up. People were like, hey, you're pay attention to the salmon and the pollution. Why don't you go check it out? And I thought, well, it'll be over before I get there. It's not a big deal. Murphy's Law. And I drove. And I got out of the car with a couple of bottles of water by 1 o'clock. And I made it up on site at about 4:32 directly across the river with my camera and started paying attention. At 4:32, remember that was 12:14 when that 911 call, there's no boom on the water here. That's Rock Creek. That's the train. And you can see the parts of the car there. And it goes like that. The overpass is right over here. Housing right over here. The wastewater treatment outfall uses that Rock Creek. So you had the train here and the water here. There's a trestle. And the river right here. Now, you can figure out that the water table is fairly permeable there. You might think, hey, I don't know, maybe we push some boom down, right? Absorbent boom, let's do that. I was surprised at 4:32 there wasn't any there on site. I was surprised I beat it. I was really surprised that I could have gone to Bob's house, hooked up his rig, took his boat, stopped off at the fire supply store, loaded up a load of boom, arrived up there, and deployed it myself. I stopped and took pictures along every stretch of the road. The freeway was jammed on State Route 14. If I had the right-of-way on 84 and was delivering this, I could have been on site at 2 o'clock, I guarantee it. I could have stopped taking pictures, and I could have been on this side by 3 o'clock, I guarantee it. I'm shocked that I beat the first responders, not just by a little, but by more than 6 hours. I mean, that's how long it took to get them there. This is the first string of boom that's coming here. We'll call it on site at 6:21. It's not in place. Now it's going through. This is obviously one of the tank cars. I guess there was three. Look how close those homes are. This other boat's in the water. There was jet skiers and water skiers. It's an amazing day up there. People observing the spill. I was just shocked at 6:21 that that's the circumstance. Second boom didn't come on until 9:06. Still in fuego, and my camera's starting to, it's looking pretty dark there. That's about as good as I got before I gave up on the night. Several days later, Clean Harbor guys, they got the vacuum truck, they got the booms out. The next morning, it was in the paper that the spill had reached the water. There was a sheen of oil on the water the next morning. This is almost a week later. They're still working on the sheen. We're very lucky that the wastewater treatment plant was ruined. because it caught a lot of the oil that came out into that outfall area that seeped through the tracks and got caught in that water wastewater treatment plant. Otherwise, it would have flowed right on out here. Untold amount of gallons. I haven't seen that report of how much oil they pumped out of the wastewater treatment plant. We do know it's ruined. We do know it caught a lot. We also know it didn't catch everything. These guys are vacuum trucking it out. This is what it's about. 8 o'clock in the morning, two fish in the boat. That's what the future needs to be. To the bill, if you will. 2131. The application threshold of 25 rail cars, why? We were just told this derailment was 16, that there were three cars in flame. Why do we only care about 25 rail cars or more? Makes no sense. Slow responsiveness. Why does the bill say, 2131, say you have 8 hours to put boom on site? I could have done it in two. Four if I took pictures. Why is the implementation of 2131 so slow? 2019, are we waiting for another governor to get tougher on oil? I don't understand that. Why are we deferring to the feds in the Northwest Area Plan and the Northwest Area Committee and relinquishing the initial sovereignty that we have in those plans? And why would we trust the federal government, which may be outsourcing more things to Honeywell and Halliburton in the future anyway in the next 4 years? What's going on with some of those definitions? What is a worst probable spill? That's a weird pair I don't really understand. Obviously, the increased financial responsiveness obligations on the railroad companies are great, and the increased responsive, the increased range of plans that are required is great. 2131 has a great heart. There's some mixing and matching in the details that we need to work on. 3344 to stop the subsidy of these projects and to consider the impacts of these projects before we cite them is very, very important. We appreciate the timeliness of the implementation of that bill as well. 3344, two thumbs up. 2131, let's do some work session work on that. Thanks very much.
Okay. Very good. Thanks for your testimony. We appreciate it. And thanks for the PowerPoint and the photos. Very unique. All right. I can't tell if we're quite done. There's a few names left. Is it Reagan Merritt? Good. And is Ryan Rittenhouse here?
That's me, but you've already heard from four representatives of my group, so I'm going to cede any further comments.
Yeah, that's the kind of
register is in favor.
That makes you very popular around here. Damon? Damon?
He's gone.
Okay. And, sir, you wanted to testify, but I don't seem to have your name, but so come on up anyway.
Actually,
if you like. I'm happy to take your testimony.
Just confirm with everything that's gone forward so far.
Okay, that's fine. Go right ahead.
Chair Helm and Representative Hulvey, thank you for staying. Really appreciate it. And for hearing these bills.
Sorry you've
My
ended
name
up
is
being
Regna
the
Merritt.
Last one.
Yeah, excuse me?
I'm sorry you've ended up to
That's
be our
okay.
last.
Sorry. My name is Regna Merritt. I'm a physician assistant, long retired. I worked in a regional trauma center on the surgical side of the emergency room. I'm here representing Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and over 4,000 health professionals and public health advocates who oppose oil by rail transport in the state of Oregon and Washington, and the storage of oil in the state of Oregon, in the states of Oregon and Washington. You've heard a lot today about the public health impacts. I just take you, you know, to a place perhaps where you can close your eyes and imagine for one moment if it was your neighborhood where there was evacuation, a school closure, your kids or your family was breathing from a toxic plume of smoke, if you lost your drinking water system because all the water was spent dousing the rails, if you lost your sewer system and couldn't flush your toilet for days, if there was the fear of contaminated groundwater and favorite fishing grounds, if you had to watch 3,000 tons of contaminated soil be removed over the course of months, if the largest freeway
and the small highway that's, that got you home at night were closed, as was I-84 and Highway 30. These are, you know, this is what the people in Mosier experienced. And even 4 months later, if you look to see what the DEQ report, the most recent one posted was from 4 months later, they were still doing and paying for groundwater testing, groundwater treatment for contamination. They were working still on the wastewater treatment plant. There was ongoing testing of Columbia River water. And they were reinstalling booms on the Columbia River as the fall rains came to ensure that there was no further movement of oil from the contaminated ground into the Columbia River. So I try and think about that. It's moving to hear the people who are commenting, but I, you know, there are not only these big public health impacts, but there are real costs, and that's kind of what both of these bills address. What would it cost to, you know, have liability, the liabilities covered? What would it cost to ensure that the residents of Oregon communities would not have to be paying for this? Well, you could, and I hope you will, look at what it costs DEQ, ODOT, the fire marshals. There's a whole panoply of agencies that put time and money into it. We ought to know exactly what those costs are, you know, up until the day we pass these bills. We should ask UP how much they've already paid out of pocket and how much they're planning to pay out of pocket, so we get a look at what the real costs for a relatively minor incident, what the real costs are and what insurance should be covered. What costs should be covered for an incident like this, or something that's much more catastrophic, as in Lac Mégantic? What are the costs of Lac Mégantic as of today? Multnomah County has great GIS resources, and there's an oil study that was done by the county before they passed a resolution opposing oil by rail and the Tesoro terminal that would bring oil through Oregon en route to Vancouver, Washington. And it's instructive. That study found that more than a quarter of Multnomah County's population lives within the half-mile blast zone. 108 schools and 100 child care facilities lie within that zone. People of color are more likely to live within the evacuation zone. And over $25 billion of improved property lies within that corridor. The study found that oil by rail has eclipsed the rail capacities of local emergency responders, and the funding for those capabilities has not kept pace. And Multnomah County has a lot more resources than many other counties do. And finally, the study found that the lifting of the U.S. oil export ban in 2015 is likely to put increased pressure for new or expanded oil by rail facilities in the Pacific Northwest. So no less important are the 88 Oregon communities through which oil by rail trains are moving now. So please, I ask on behalf of both Physicians for Social Responsibility and as co-director of the PowerPass Coalition, to support in general these two bills. And I would add that some minor amendments should be made to make them better, and we'd be happy to work with you on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate that. Did I miss anybody? Very good. Thank you all for coming and being part of this hearing today. I'm glad we were able to get all the testimony in for both bills. I'm going to close the hearing on HB 3344, and I'm going to carry over House Bill 2131 to tomorrow night's agenda, which is our special climate change response informational sessions. But at that meeting, we'll be carrying over HB 2131 to Wednesday's agenda so that we can have the testimony of Bruce Gillies or Giles, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing, Abby Boduras, Martina Ruiz-Temple, and Michael Hefner. Those are all agency folks that came today to testify, and I released them so they didn't need to spend their evening with us as well. With that, I think we can close this hearing. So thank you all for coming again, and the House Committee on Environment and Energy is adjourned. Yeah. Is adjourned.